Support for Boston Public Radio comes from the University of Massachusetts Amherst. Be revolutionary. UMass is the Commonwealth's flagship public research university and committed to the relentless pursuit of progress. Learn more at umass.edu.
Today on Boston Public Radio, live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. Today, hundreds of thousands of federal employees will get a look at their pay stub for the work they did last week. So what will they see? A bunch of zeros. Air traffic controllers, TSA screeners, IRS tax examiners, FEMA officials, and so many more federal workers aren't getting that injection that the rest of us will today. With Friday being payday for most of us, not just government workers, we'll open the lines and ask what would happen if your net pay today was nothing. From there, Emily Rooney joins us for her famous list of fixations and fulminations.
At noon, Mayor Marty Walsh joins us for Ask the Mayor, where he'll take our questions and your calls. Then it's time for Better Call Sean. The Boston Globe consumer advocacy reporter Sean Murphy is here to go over the latest cases of people who have been abused big time by big business. All that is next on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Rowdy, I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. It's Friday, and we are broadcasting live, as we do every Friday, from the WGBH studio at the Boston Public Library. Hello.
Hello there, Marjorie. I have a couple of announcements to make.
Okay.
Marjorie. One, a number of tweeters of me and the show said I should high-five you. You're too far away for your fabulous column in today's Globe.
Thank you.
And it is
very fabulous, Jim.
Terrific. What is it about, Marjorie?
It's about the fact that we think of people like Elizabeth Warren as really far left and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is really far left. But when you look at their positions, you look at polls, they represent what most Americans want. And Donald Trump and the Republicans are not representing what most Americans want.
And if you stay tuned to when Emily Rooney joins us in about a half hour, we're going to talk about Marjorie's column as compared to Joan Vernocchi's column, where she equates to a degree Ocasio-Cortez to Sarah Palin. Number two, we want to let you know at 1:30 on Monday, Stop Everything, Guster, which spent its 25th anniversary with us in the library. They have a new CD coming out, I think, on Friday of next week. They're going to give a live performance out at GBH at 1:30, so have your radio tuned in. And finally, the mayor, as we announced, is coming. He will be here at noon. So if you have questions, tweet him to BOS Public Radio, or you can email us to bpr@wgbh.org. So nearly 80% of American workers say they're living paycheck to paycheck. And today, for nearly 800,000 federal employees, they're living paycheck to no paycheck. The government shutdown means there's no payday on payday. But it's not just federal workers who are expecting a paycheck today. It's most of us. We're opening the lines asking, what if this were you at 877-301-8970? We've been reading stories about federal workers who are going into credit card debt, who are having to take out loans, who are picking up second jobs. What would the repercussions be for you if you did not get paid today? And obviously, if you're among the federal workers or contractors who get nothing today, we would love to hear from you at 877-301-8970. This insane shutdown, as you just heard on the NPR News, ties the record for the longest. And my prediction, I think we had this discussion with Chuck Todd yesterday, is since the president likes to be number one, I assume this matters to him. Tomorrow, when we break the all-time record for the longest shutdown of the government in American history, I'm guessing, Marjorie, that that's when he declares a national emergency and this whole process starts with him unilaterally attempting to fund the building of the wall, at which time, hopefully, the government will reopen. Whether it does or not, this whole thing has been unconscionable and totally indefensible. And I'll tell you, most people I know, not just really low-income people, most people I know, you saw that statistic all over the place, 80% of our fellow Americans live paycheck to paycheck, and a million of them today are not getting a paycheck.
Well, you know, it's incredible because we thought and that we're going to be helped by this tax cut in terms of wages. And I've read different things. Bob Reich, who writes this piece in The Guardian, says wages, in fact, went down for the second quarter of this year. And other people say that they have gone up, and we can have people call us and say they've got more in their paycheck, a little bit more in their paycheck, not huge amounts of money in their paycheck. But I guess the thing is, it's so clear, and this is part of what I write about today in The Globe, it is so clear that since the 80s, the middle class has gone down and down and down. And I'm old enough to remember, you know, when one paycheck in one family, mom and dad both weren't working. It was usually dad that was working in those days. And one paycheck could cover kind of not an extravagant life, but a life where you could probably get your kids at least part of the way through college. That stuff is all over now. And he points out, Robert Reich does, and he, of course, is a liberal guy, but I think he's right about this, that we have lost bargaining power. Workers have lost bargaining power. There's far fewer people in unions now.
7% in the private sector.
The people that do well in unions now are government workers for the most part, who have very strong unions, although they've been hurt by the Supreme Court decision. We'll have to see what happens, as Donald Trump likes to say. We'll see what happens. But they still have good benefits, and they still have reasonable retirement and so forth. But everybody else is – and why we don't – you know, I'll shut up in 1 second, but there was a very interesting piece I read a couple of days ago talking about middle class shame, how Americans, for some reason, blame ourselves when we are not making enough money. Something wrong with me. As Europeans, we always talk about them being out in the front lines.
Well, it's our individualistic thing in this country.
Yes, that they blame the system. And I think it's pretty obvious that the system has been rigged against the middle class in the United States since the 80s.
So when you're contemplating giving us the buzz at 877-301-8970, not only would we like you to think about what would happen if you didn't draw a paycheck today, it's actually worse for these people. Because they don't know when they're going to get a paycheck. And while even the president said yesterday they will get repaid, even though contract workers will not be repaid retroactively, you don't get a paycheck today. You say to yourself, well, maybe I won't get the next paycheck or the next paycheck. It is beyond the financial hardship. The psychological, it's almost like terrorism. It's financial terrorism against almost a million people. And we talked about the trickle-down effect, the small businesses that depend on federal workers in some communities, the whole host of things. And you keep hearing about all this pain. By the way, in fairness, because you always say every time we have an opportunity to say the president has gotten something right, I haven't heard a very persuasive case for the wall at all. Yesterday, I would have to admit this, during his border visit yesterday, the president gave the most coherent explanation of why we need the wall. It was in a comparison of walls to wheels. And I'd like you to listen to this, and I think it will really open your eyes. Here it is.
They say a wall is medieval. Well, so is a wheel. A wheel is older than a wall. And I looked, and every single car out there, even the really expensive ones that the Secret Service uses, and believe me, they are expensive. I said, do they all have wheels? Yes. Oh, I thought it was medieval. The wheel is older than the wall. You know that? And there are some things that work. You know what? A wheel works and a wall works.
That does it for me. I'll tell you, 877-301-8970. And in addition to calling in and talking about how you'd fare if you didn't get a paycheck today, if anybody can explain what the president was trying to say yesterday about the wheel and the wall, we would love to hear from you.
Did you throw out the 40% of Americans can't cover a four-in-a-bucket expense?
We've said it a few times this week. Say it again.
That's a number that's been tossed around over and over again that, as I just said, 4 in 10 Americans, according to the Federal Reserve board report, can't cover $400 emergency expense.
Of an unexpected expense. It is just unbelievable. And the reason we even brought this up today, we should say, is we've all been talking about it in the abstract, and I hope most of us show some empathy to these workers who are getting nothing today. But it becomes much more real since the paycheck for many, if not most Americans, is a Friday. For us at GBH, today is paycheck day. And we thought we'd like to get your sense of, you know, imagine, close your eyes for a second unless you're driving. Close your eyes and imagine if your paycheck wasn't there today and you didn't know when the next one was coming.
And the other thing is, too, there's a lot of, you know, part of the guilt and shame about not having enough money is that, well, I'm spending too much on my Comcast account or I'm spending too much on my cell phone. Well, you may be, but those aren't the things that are crushing you. It's housing, it's college education, it's child care, it's health care. I mean, it's all those things that you really don't have very much power to change.
Paula in North Attleboro, you're first on Boston Public Radio. Thank you much for calling. Hi.
Oh, good morning, and thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My daughter, excuse me, is a TSA worker.
Oh.
She has to go in. She has to work. She is, like, totally stressed out to the max. Her husband is a roofer, so they never know if he's going to work a full day or not, depending on the weather, all this other stuff. And, you know, she's scrambling. I mean, everybody is trying to help them out as much as they can. My grandson called her the other day at work and said, I have to get a new pair of sneakers. They ripped today. And she was like going, oh, my God, where am I going to come up with the money for his sneakers? And so, you know, we watch all this stuff, and I think the most disgusting thing, and there's so many to pick from Trump and his comments, was where he said he could sympathize with these people. And
I can relate, he said.
They're struggling.
Yep.
Yeah, I can relate. And it's like, what? Did his father hold back $1,000 on his allowance 1 week or something?
You know, Paula, I think the most important thing you said when you're talking about your kid was that she is stressed to the max, because while we've spoken a lot about the financial pain and this causes, think about the stress, the psychological stress. And by the way, not just hopefully caring about your daughter and people like her. With all due respect to your daughter, when I feel like crap and I come to work and I'm stressed, I don't do as well as I do other days. I'm assuming it affects everything she does. So our thoughts are with your kid, and we hope she's paid soon, and you really represented her well. Paula, thanks so much for your call.
By the way, I just got an email from John saying exactly what I just said. The problem is not that we can't make a living. The problem is we don't save. We spend it on cell phones and $200 a month cable bills and 100-plus tennis shoes instead of putting away money. But with all due respect, John, it just seems what I've been reading this week is it's not those things. I mean, you probably shouldn't be doing those things if you don't have any money, but it's those other things.
Did you add to your list the fact that there are no pensions for anybody anymore?
Talking
about a generation, a lot of us have 401ks,
yeah.
A lot of us don't.
Right.
But virtually none of us have defined benefit pensions where you know that money is going to be set aside and you have a retirement that is not just dependent on Social Security.
Yeah, think about the people that you knew in your parents' or your grandparents' generation that worked for big companies.
It's like your father at Firestone.
He worked for Firestone all his life. And when he retired at... he didn't get to retire, but he was about to retire, and he would have gotten a pension. And
Same with my father. Had he not been disbarred, that would have been a really 877-301-8970. Jerry in a car, you're next on Boston Public Radio. Thanks for calling in. Hi.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I'm a relatively new listener and a first-time caller.
Thank you.
I work as a contractor for the Coast Guard down on the Cape, and I work with colleagues who are in the Coast Guard who are not getting paid today. I am going to get paid, which I haven't figured that out yet, but I'm going to get paid, and I look at these people that I work with, and my heart goes out to them, and I feel guilty about it, that I'm getting a paycheck. But the other point I really want to stress is, the president would be better well served, and we would be better well served if we took that $5.1 billion and gave it to our military as a pay raise. And Lord knows that these folks need it. They could use the money much better than a useless structure on a border. And if you're going to build walls, you have to put a roof on it.
Well, a lot of people have talked about flyovers, too. You know, speaking of pay raise for the military, where was the president? In Iraq?
Iraq the other day? He told a big whopper about how he was giving everybody a 10% pay raise. And people said to him, no, you could make it 2%. You could make it 4%. No, I said I'm going to make it 10%. And it's the biggest pay raise I've ever had. Well, in fact, the pay raise was, I think, 2.6%.
Whatever it was.
And
it
wasn't 10%. And it was another. And the pay raises have been going up modestly.
He said
every
it was the first
year.
In 10 years.
Yeah, that was a big whopper. He told. You know what's amazing?
Hey, Jerry,
really,
thanks for your first call. Please make another one soon. Thanks for listening.
That Congress hasn't sacrificed their salaries during this
whole
thing.
Well, some have individually.
Individually, but shouldn't they all be?
By the way, Warren, who you wrote about this morning, is amongst those who did contribute a salary. I'm not sure if it's to the Treasury or to charity. I think the answer is they surely should. 877-301-8970.
It's incredible. You think of the money you make. I mean, a million years ago, I was a waitress. She used to be a waiter. I worked as a waitress for a long time. Mm-hmm. I think I made more money, or at least as much money then, as people make waiting on tables now. Partly because you have to pay more in taxes.
Well,
now,
you see the point that was made by Reich in his piece in The Guardian is people adjusted for inflation people are making the exact same amount of money today as they made 40 years ago. The middle class he's talking about, not people at the top. The same income that they had 40 years ago after it's adjusted for
and
inflation.
He talks about this being having to do with policies. It's not just it's unionization has taken a huge hit in the private sector, but it's also these corporations have banded together like to form like monopolies so that workers don't have much of a bargaining power, as I said before. And the other big thing is that companies operate in a different way now. It's all about shareholders. It's all about money for the shareholders. So there's been I've read conflicting things, but you know that the corporations got these huge tax breaks. There's been stories about people passing them on to their employees, but there's also been stories about corporations not passing them on to their employees, just passing it on to their shareholders, or these massive salaries.
Well, there's one thing you gotta add to that equation. When I was younger, I was a lobbyist both in Washington and here. There was a dramatic shift. The power of businesses. You remember when Dick Durbin, the senator from Illinois, said Congress is a wholly owned subsidiary of the banking industry? I think that's fair. The influence that major businesses have over legislative bodies, with some exceptions right. in this country, as compared to workers have in this country, it's been a dramatic shift.
And remember when the Republicans were trying to pass the tax break that went to the corporations and wealthy people? A lot of them were quite frank in saying, well, the donors insist that we do this, the people mm-hmm. that fund their campaigns. And the donors, of course, are people who are millionaires and billionaires who are stood to benefit from this huge tax break and the estate tax.
877-301-8897. Let's go to West Brookfield, where Lauren is on the phone. Lauren, welcome to Boston Public Radio. Hi.
Hey, how are you guys?
Great.
I listen to you every day.
Thanks.
And I've been trying to get in for a couple days, because I'm never one to publicly, I guess, outside of my husband, talk about politics too much because it upsets me, mm-hmm. like many people, I'm sure. I'm the only provider for our family right now. My husband worked for Dow Chemical for 10 years and was laid off after his plant was moved overseas.
Oh.
With his severance, we opened a small business in the city of Worcester, which did not survive. Mm. We funded it out of pocket, which means that we've lost every single thing that we have.
Oh, my God.
Currently staying with friends to try to pick ourselves back up. I listen to our president every day, and I feel this heat in my heart that reminds me of indigestion. And it... you know, it's hard to have someone tell them that he can relate to us, to people who live paycheck to paycheck, when he has no idea what it is to live like us. You know, and I'm sure I'm not the only person who feels that. You know, every day he's talking about this wall and spreading lies that are pretty bigoted, when he forgets that our country was founded by an indigenous people before Europeans came over. You know, but these are things that are forgotten in all this wall talk.
Yeah.
And it's hard, you know. It's hard to be someone who pays taxes every year and who has a bachelor's degree but can't get a job that pays me more than $13 an hour.
Hey, Lauren, we're really glad you finally decided to make a call. That was a great one and a powerful one. And we wish you and your husband luck. I think Lauren speaks for a lot of people in this country, a lot of people in this country.
Well, a lot of people have emailed to say that when you get laid off after 40 or 50, it's really hard to find another job, too, because there's significant age discrimination.
Globe has done great stories on that, by the way. Great stories about older people who are able to get a job, have to get a job well below their qualifications and pay rate, just like Lauren talked about a couple of... seconds ago. I hope people take her thoughts to heart. Our number is 877-301-8970.
We are talking about the government shutdown, and we're talking about it today because it's payday for lots of people, asking you how you would manage if you didn't get your paycheck today. That conversation continues on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Brady and Marjorie Egan. We're live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. The mayor is going to join us at 12 o'clock. One of the things we're going to ask him about is the impact of this federal government shutdown on our city, on Boston. If you're just tuning in, we're talking about the government shutdown with a focus on the 800,000 federal workers who are not getting paid today on payday. It's an issue that is highlighting how many of us are living paycheck to paycheck. Apparently, 80% of all workers in this country are. And we're using this as an opportunity to ask you what your life would be like if this were you on payday, 877-301-8970. If you didn't get paid today, would you have to skip your mortgage payment or rent? Would you have to skimp on food? Or are you lucky enough to have some sort of financial cushion? Marjorie mentioned that incredible statistic from the Federal Reserve Bank that 40%, 4 out of 10 Americans, if they had an unexpected expenditure, cost, demand on them of $400, could not come up.
And you know
with
what else? Do you know what else is outrageous?
What's that?
If the Democrats want to do something that a lot of people can relate to, why are interest rates on credit cards 18%? You know, they used to rise with the prime. I mean, they used to be like 3 and 4. Well, I don't know if they were ever that low. But when the prime rate was lower, they were lower. Then they rose during, I think, during Carter's time, was it? And they just never came back down. I mean, it is incredible. The prime rate for a mortgage is what? What are 30 mortgage? 30,
I don't know, 4 something?
4 something?
I don't know.
And people that will go out and borrow the $400 because they don't have enough money to pay in cash are going to put it in the credit card and then get charged 18%.
I asked one Congressman Frank years ago about when I was interviewing him because he was head of the Financial Services Committee.
Yeah.
Why don't members of Congress just federally cap interest rates?
Yeah, why not?
I don't remember what the answer was.
Well,
but it seems to me,
have to do with money, don't you think?
Whoever that person is would probably be the next president of the United States if he or she led that charge.
It was suspected it has to do with money from Visa and MasterCard or whoever else is powerful in that regard. American Express, I don't know, but it's just crazy. It makes you wonder why we put up with this. I mean, that's like a total
discussion we had last week
scam.
About people out on the streets all over Western Europe and the rest of the world. And we tweet about those things. That's our protest.
Jason in Newport. What do you think, Jason?
Hey, Jason.
Well, I was just calling in. I wanted to tie two of the topics that you're discussing today.
Sure.
I've done academic research in political demography, and one of the things I'm able to show qualitatively and quantitatively is that when you have extreme rises of income inequality, xenophobia rises, especially when you have a new group moving into an indigenous population. And I think that with the rise of the nationalism that we've seen, with the rise of xenophobia, and the call for building a wall, actually is a systemic of what you're talking about since the 1980s with income inequality and stagnant wages. And again, I'm able to show it quantitative and qualitatively with some of the academic research I've done.
Send it to us, bprwgbh.org. I mean, people do tend, when they're stressed and feel under attack, they are ripe for a demagogue to convince them that they should take it out on somebody else. And the President of the United States, very skillfully, has convinced a lot of stressed Americans that the people they should take it out on are people who are leaving violence and other things in their country in an attempt to get here.
Taking jobs was one of his big arguments the other night in the speech, that people coming in over the southern border, and they were taking the jobs of people, particularly African-Americans and Latinos. I don't know if that's true, but that's what he said.
Whoa. As a matter of fact, if you read the Washington Post, it is totally untrue. We're going to discuss it with Callie Crossley in about an hour.
Because it's actually taking more jobs from white people.
You should stick around, Marjorie.
Yeah, okay.
It's on Callie's list of topics. Where should we go next?
Let's go to Mary in the car. Hi, Mary.
Hi, Mary.
Hi, I love your show.
Thanks.
Thank you so much.
Thanks.
For the job you do. I'm self-employed, so I can relate to people who are going without a paycheck to some degree. But I get paid, I'm an interior designer, so I get paid for projects. So I work, I have to put a lot of hours in before I reap the benefits. And I felt so bad for that woman who called earlier.
It's awful.
About sneakers that her child wanted.
Yeah.
You know, my kids will ask me for things, and it's a teachable moment. You know, I tell them we're going to get extra things when I get paid, and I'm teaching them you don't spend money you don't have. And I know I'm going to be getting a check, and I can pay my taxes and my bills and then take care of it. But sometimes if projects get delayed, I have to wait to get paid, and it can be a struggle. So I really feel for these people. Well, and, you know, at times I have to. Go ahead.
No, you mentioned, I think her name was Lauren, who was actually her granddaughter, who asked her daughter for those sneakers. I don't know how old the granddaughter was, but you could tell your kid, Mary, well, this is the kind of business I have. It's a project-based business, and hopefully the kid would understand. What does Lauren's daughter tell her daughter? How does she explain why she doesn't have money for the sneakers? Because the president of the United States has decided it's more important that we build a wall that not one congressperson who represents any footage on the wall thinks is a good idea, 9 out of 9, including a Republican, and that's why I don't have enough money to buy you sneakers. I mean, it is really, there's so many tentacles of this thing that make this an unbelievable mess. Mary, thanks for the call. We appreciate it. 877-301-8970.
You know, our staff reminded us that everybody's saddled with student debt now, too, because of the college costs.
You said that.
Were astronomical.
Yeah, that
was... I mean, that's just so huge. You know, and that's just...
Well, also, if you don't pay your college loan, Betsy DeVos probably can have you deported, even if you're a citizen. I mean, it's just...
Well, that's the other thing. She's on the side... Of these for-profit schools, many of whom have been in court for fraudulent representation of what they do and for fraudulent deals on financing. Why would you be on the side of people that have done illegal
things?
One
of the leaders of the for-profit scam schools, she appointed as one of her assistant secretaries of education. By the way,
and of
Maura
course, Donald
Healy,
Trump, as we know, had to pay a $25 million fine for his
Trump
own
University.
Fraudulent scam.
Maura Healy
deal.
And her predecessor, Martha Coakley, did fabulous work. I would argue as good as any place in the country on these for-profit scam institutions. It's just, it's horrible.
Well,
so what was your question? Why is she doing it?
It's all kind of like a big scam, which we've mostly fallen for. Mm. The idea that if you're going to give big tax cuts to wealthy people, it's going to all trickle down. Well, there's no question the economy, in terms of employment, is doing really well now. But as these stories point out, part of the reason it's doing really well, people aren't making enough money in these one job, so they have 2 and 3 jobs, and unemployment is low, but it's not transferring to wealth increasing for the most part.
I don't think that's the reason. I think the reason why the economy in some aspects is doing well is because a wheel works as well as a wall. By the way, the fact that nobody has explained to us what the president was talking about yesterday when he said whatever he says the wheel is older than the wall. You know that. There's some things that work. A wheel works and a wall works. So you're pretty insightful. What exactly was he getting at there?
I don't know. Something about medieval times.
And a wheel and a wall.
The Dark Ages.
And a wheel and a wall.
When they came up with the wheel. I think they came up with the wheel though, long before medieval times, didn't they?
I don't really know.
Yeah, I think they were around for a long time.
I really don't
you know,
know.
The Romans had the chariots, don't you remember?
But I know. A wheel works and a wall works. I mean, it's pretty hard to
quarrel. When do we come up with the wheel? Do you know that, Jim?
I do not know.
You should know that.
I do not
Day
know.
On the road. What do you think, Dane?
Hey, Dane.
First off, I mean, I feel a lot of sympathy for the federal workers. But with anything like with a catastrophic event, a lot of people think that the government's there for them, but until they go through it, they really don't find out. Like, I had a situation where I went through workers' comp, and I thought that basically it was set up to help the employee, but quickly found out that, you know, again and again, the employer is the beneficiary of all the laws, which you kind of were discussing about a little bit briefly, that it really has switched from the middle class being in power or having the power, and it's really all the corporations now that control the laws, the politicians, and everything.
I don't think that's an opinion or a rhetorical statement. I think that is a statement of fact in 2019. Dane, thank you for the call. Do you remember, speaking of corporations running everything, do you remember the great documentary that, was it Frontline? I think it was Frontline did, on Scott, what was the name of the guy who was running EPA there for a while?
I forget.
When Scott Pruitt was there, and he was denying the influence when he had been Attorney General of Oklahoma that they had, the fossil fuel companies that had, on his legislative or regulatory agenda. And do you remember, I think it was Frontline that found this, that a piece of legislation that he had filed or a regulation that he had filed as the head of the EPA was verbatim the exact same regulation that they got a copy of on the stationery of one of the fossil fuel companies from Oklahoma had sent them, I guess through a freedom of information thing or something.
Well, that's,
I mean, that
yeah.
is the reality.
And fossil fuels have a lot of money. They convince a lot of people that climate change isn't as bad as it is, even though the scientists, 99.9% of them are all saying it's worse. The oceans are getting hotter. And the Consumer Protection Bureau that Elizabeth Warren, you know, that was her big deal yeah. to protect consumers from big corporations like the call I just mentioned. The Trump administration has essentially gutted that.
They have.
So that if you have a problem with one of these big corporations or even a class action with a bunch of other people who've also been defrauded by these big corporations, you really have very little recourse. Again, you say to yourself, who's on the side? Who favors cheating against the little
well,
guy?
Well, you know, corporations are people, too. You know, one last thing about this, by the way, in the spirit of even-handedness, a huge number of Democrats are owned. It's not just Republicans.
Absolutely.
Are owned
Absolutely.
By these corporate lobbyists, too.
It's I mean. All the way, it is all the way across the board. But at least they just filed legislation on pharmaceuticals, or they filed bills on pharmaceuticals in the House. We'll see what happens if they actually vote against lowering prescription drugs or won't do anything
cost, yeah.
in the Senate. What do you think?
Well, I don't know. Yeah, well, just keep in mind, when candidate Trump, until he had that meeting in February of 2017 with Big Pharma, his two proposals are excellent ones. One, to allow for the importation of drugs from Canada, which would lower prices,
yep.
obviously, assuming there were safety precautions taken. And two, that Medicare finally be able to negotiate drug
yeah.
prices. And the fact that they're statutorily prohibited from doing it is unexplainable, and unconscionable.
And that's another, we left that reason off. That's another reason why people are broke, especially when they get older and they need more medicine because they can't afford to pay for it.
Exactly.
Anyway, coming up, Emily Rooney's here for a famous list of preoccupations
Thank
and
goodness.
Proclamations. She's next on 89.7. I'll tell you, we're going to hell in a handbasket, Jim. Hell in a handbasket. 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio, live from the WGBH studio at the Boston Public Library.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. Marjorie and I were preparing our lunch menu, our lunch request, so we almost weren't ready to come back on the air. Our apologies. Joining us, as she always does on Fridays, for a famous list of fixations and fulminations and more, is Emily Rooney, host of Beat the Press, which you can catch Friday nights at 7 o'clock on WGBH. Hello, Emily Rooney.
Hey, Jim. Hey, Marge. How are you?
Hello,
good.
Emily Rooney.
We're good.
Well, a lot of people are obsessed with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Apparently, a fake nude selfie was just put out
oh,
of her.
I know.
It wasn't her. There's been a lot of fixation on her from Republicans, a lot of fixation on her from Democrats as well. Joan Vinaki just wrote a column comparing Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez to Sarah Palin in terms of not knowing as much as she should. We're going to play a little clip from Anderson Cooper's interview with her on 60 Minutes the other night when she's talking about being quote-unquote factually correct and about her tax plan.
I think that there's a lot of people more concerned about being precisely, factually, and semantically correct than about being morally right.
But being factually correct is important.
It's absolutely important. And whenever I make a mistake, I say, okay, this was clumsy. And then I restate what my point was. You know, you look at our tax rates back in the 60s, and when you have a progressive tax rate system, your tax rate, you know, let's say from $0 to $75,000 may be 10% or 15%, et cetera. But once you get to, like, the tippy tops. On your 10 millionth dollar, sometimes you see tax rates as high as 60 or 70%. That doesn't mean all $10 million are taxed at an extremely high rate, but it means that as you climb up this ladder, you should be contributing more.
I think that's a pretty good explanation of marginal tax rates as far as I'm concerned.
I think the bigger point that Joan Vinaki was making, though, about Ocasio-Cortez is that the mainstream press has not pushed back at her. Conservative press has. You'd seen Fox News and others already saying that, you know, the top 1% pay 37.5% of the taxes, that kind of thing. But Sarah Palin was vilified from the very beginning by everybody. I just went back and looked at that interview that Katie Couric did, you know, asking her about why does being near Russia make you an expert in foreign policy? And we're the pushing her and pushing her. And she had terrible answers, but she was widely mocked for not having some solid proposals to back up her ideas. And even with Ocasio-Cortez, like
Ocasio-Cortez.
Ocasio, because it's the C first, right?
Ocasio-Cortez.
No, it's a tongue twister.
Oh, and then C. Go ahead. Yeah.
We're going to go fossil fuelless within 12 years. She didn't have a real plan. What are you going to do? Have the government take over the car industry? How are you going to accomplish some of those things? But no one has really pushed back on her.
Well, let me just say, I think I do the mandatory. I'm a big fan of Jones. I think the comparison was insanely ridiculous. Sarah Palin knew nothing about nothing. She was on the verge, potentially, of being a heartbeat away from the presidency. Ocasio-Cortez, while she's getting a ton of press, is a freshman congressperson who's got a bully pulpit, but has absolutely no power. She's one of 435 people. And frankly, while she has made some mistakes, she, at least from what I... And by the way, she tweeted after this thing with Anderson Cooper and spoke to the issue of factual mistakes. Her answer was not great on that particular issue. But I think the comparison, even though you may be right about how the mainstream press has handled her, Emily, I think the comparison is so wildly inappropriate. It's ridiculous. You want to break the tie, Marjorie?
Well, I mean, I do think that's the problem. I mean, I think people went into a panic about Sarah Palin because John McCain was older. He had a couple of bouts of cancer. He had a lot of health problems. And you said people were saying to themselves, oh, my God, this woman could be the president of the United States if something happens to John McCain. I think that's the problem.
No, I agree with that. And we're going to do that tonight to be the president. I made that exact same point, that she was a vice presidential candidate, mm-hmm. which was a much higher level. But here's the thing. Ocasio-Cortez has gotten a tremendous amount of press.
Boy, is
she has gotten a profile on the front page of the New York Times, an interview with Anderson Cooper. She more attention than any other new member in Congress, even Ayanna Pressley, who's gotten quite a bit.
I would say more than any member of Congress.
Yeah, maybe ever. Yeah. So she's not being held to a standard that the press would normally hold somebody of that stature. We've anointed her with that stature, and yet no one is really holding her accountable.
Well, I think
that's my point.
I think she really goofed on Claire McCaskill. I think she'd got a lot of pushback on that.
Can you explain that for those who don't know?
Well, she misrepresented Claire McCaskill's positions on a couple of things, and I don't remember what the positions were, but they were. It was
McCaskill
wrong.
Just left the Senate. She was defeated from Missouri,
Democrat. And did it have to do with immigration? I forget.
I don't remember
whatever it was, she had McCaskill's positions absolutely wrong. And before you're going to tweet about somebody, you should make sure that you have her positions correct, and she didn't. So that was a problem. But I think the thing is different. She's 29 years old. She's dancing around. I mean, she's young. She's got these different ideas. I think it's
but it's ideological favoritism. There just isn't any question about it. People like her because of all those things you've just said. And she admits she's a radical. She's way to the left of center.
But she's not.
What Marjorie says
not.
In the
when
paper
you look,
this
like
morning.
when you look at her tax plan, it's something that lots of people have said, I wrote about this today, including a lot of economists have said this is a tried and true tax plan, which we had. We were at 70% for the highest rate.
I don't know how true it was. It was tried, that's for sure. But it went away.
Well, it went away with Ronald Reagan.
After years.
From the period of the 35 years of the most extensive expansion of the middle class in America, the tax rates began at 90% for the highest people, and it was up to 70% for over $216,000 until Ronald Reagan became the president. Then he started lowering taxes on the wealthy, talking about trickle-down economics, mm-hmm. which clearly has not worked because income inequality has gone up and up and up and up. It's a scam, Emily.
Can I say one thing about this before we leave the topic? I said I complimented Ocasio-Cortez for explaining marginal tax rates. People like Grover Norquist, head of Americans for Tax Reform, who's a local kid, by the way, who's become a huge national stature, compared what Ocasio-Cortez proposed to slavery and made the point that being taxed at 70% was like slaves being, quote, taxed at 100%. Beyond how offensive that is, it's also not true. Just for those, what Ocasio-Cortez is proposing, whether you like the idea or not, as she said, you're not taxed at 70% if you're making $50,000 or $100,000 or a million. you're not even taxed at 70% if you make $20 million. You're only taxed on that portion of your income
that exceeds
$10 million. $20, yeah. Again, you may hate that, but at least understand it before you decide to trash her.
And I think that's kind of the scam that people have fallen for, this idea that it's going to trickle down. And that's kind of been debunked all over the place.
So, Emily Rooney, when I was teasing at the end of my show last night what you were talking about tonight, I know one of the things you're talking about on the air is the decision of the networks to air the president's speech to begin with. And what I read, and I had totally forgotten this, I'm embarrassed to say, is while the cable networks broadcast Obama's speech on immigration in 2014, the networks decided not to. And the only quotes I could find from network people was because it was, quote, overtly political, right, which obviously the president's last 2 nights ago was as well. Where do you come out on this thing?
Well, first of all, President Obama never made a direct request to the networks.
Oh, I didn't know that.
So he didn't get turned down.
I see.
So he floated the idea, and then there was a discussion amongst network executives. I guess they all got together and decided, which is kind of unusual. That's collusion. that they're all going to get together and decide. Maybe one of them, you know, would have done it, but they all decided not to do it. So they floated. And by the way, they did carry other addresses of Obama and every other president from the Oval Office. So it was that one on immigration. This was no choice.
I agree with you.
The networks did the right thing. They had to do it. You can't prejudge a speech. See, Obama's mistake was letting them know exactly what he was going to say. We had a pretty good idea what President Trump was going to say, but he promised it was going to be newsworthy. Anything from the Oval Office takes on a dramatic sense of urgency, like an immediate necessity. This clearly wasn't.
Well,
that's
especially
the way he
except for the fact not only do I agree with you that they made the right choice the other night, but the difference is context. The government had been shut down, what was it, 17, 18 days at this point. That creates a different dynamic, too. So even if after the fact there was nothing
really
new.
Which he never really addressed, other than blaming
national emergency. I assume you thought they should broadcast it, too.
I don't know. I mean, I think he's a different kettle of fish because of his constant lies.
Yeah, but you can't take that into consideration.
So what does that mean? You never put him on television?
If you're a network executive, he's the president of the United States.
Well, you have to say to yourself, okay, he's totally scammed all the networks this time because he didn't make any news and he didn't do anything but a campaign speech.
But everybody is onto that. Now we know.
So what happens?
I was really offended by some of the afterward criticism by James Poniewozik and Margaret Sullivan and those people saying that the network should be ashamed and it was a gutless move. Meanwhile, all these people were streaming it, by the way, on their websites. They didn't have a choice.
Well, also, I'll answer your question. What the networks did, and I assume will do again, while there's always a rebuttal to a State of the Union, they gave the two Democrats who totally blew the response.
Terrible.
It was atrocious.
Yep.
But they said, we're going to give him his chance.
That was unprecedented.
And in anticipation of him, quote, lying, to quote you, they said, well, let the Democrats respond.
That has
that's
never
the fact
happened.
Check. I agree.
That was the first
Except
time.
On State of the Union stuff.
Yeah, but that's different.
So,
but my point is,
that's how the networks decided. I thought fairly.
Yeah.
And the fact that Pelosi and Schumer did a horrible job is not the network's fault. They took what looked like three hostage videos.
Can we just talk about that?
The
sophistication of those two. They've been dealing with the media for decades and decades. You know what I thought they should have done? Sit down on a set, two chairs. Jim, there's been a lot of misinformation going on about border security.
Like a conversation.
Just have a conversation.
I couldn't agree with you more.
Why don't you explain what you think is, and I'll tell you, and just go back and forth.
Like normal people.
Like normal people.
Yeah.
I agree.
They're really smart people,
and one assume.
I conjured up American Gothic, too. And then
exactly.
Instantly, that was the meme that
exactly.
came in.
Exactly.
You know, part of it, I this is a really cynical interpretation, but part of it I also think was ratings. Donald Trump is golden ratings, and Barack Obama was
I'm going to tell you something right now. That is just a fallacy. They're not looking at that and thinking, oh, we're going to – first of all, it's only 7 minutes or 9 minutes. You're not going to get any ratings. In fact, it's a turnoff, a big turnoff. And the Democrats were even a bigger turnoff. So
I thought 20 million people watched the thing.
Yeah, I know, but it's not a ratings decision. I'm going to push back on that.
Okay.
The executives aren't sitting around going, oh, we're going to get a bigger – no.
So what do they do next time? Do they get scammed again, or do they – how do they handle it?
Well, I wouldn't
it?
Say they were scammed. They did the right thing. You can't prejudge something. And well, by the way, next time it may not be from the Oval Office, which makes a big difference.
But you are scammed if somebody tells you it's going to be a very important address, it's going to make a lot of news, it's going to be very important, and then it gets on and does a campaign speech.
So what do you do next time if you're on a network? Say, I want to see your speech in advance, Mr. President, before I let you know?
I don't know.
But give a chance to the other side to rebut. What more can you do?
I guess, but as we just finished saying, they turned Obama down when he wanted to do an
immigration
speech.
He apparently didn't want to do it. I love the fact that all that stuff leaked out of the luncheon with the reporter. Mm-hmm. He said, this isn't going to make any difference, and I really don't want to do it. My advisors are telling me to do it.
Here's a suggestion. One of our colleagues, Amanda, you don't run it live, and then you air it simultaneously with fact checks after you've had a chance to vet it. No. What's wrong with that? Why does that have to
be live?
I guess
I'm wondering, where was the massive upset when Obama was rejected after he floated his speech?
He floated the idea, but there wasn't any, because he never asked for the time. He never said, I've got to have the time. That's the difference with what Donald Trump did. He asked for the time.
Well, I'm with Emily. I think that even though the thing was atrocious, I think they made the right decision. Before we get to the list, this is a hot one for Marjorie. City Council.
You don't even
Zakim
live in the Back Bay.
And Marjorie
I live
are
on
the same side.
Yeah.
Can you explain what Zakim is proposing, Marjorie?
Well, I have been complaining for some time about a lot of the walks that go down, the Walk for Hunger, the Boston Marathon, the Walk for All Sorts of Diseases.
How about the corporate race?
All sorts of diseases. You are horrible.
Well, they're very worthy causes, but they all go down Beacon Street, and if they were all going down Inman Street in Cambridge, you wouldn't like it either. They all go down Beacon Street, and it causes a big problem because people can't get out.
They shut down Conn Avenue.
We haven't said what Zakim is proposing.
He is proposing,
he wants a cap on road races.
That's right. He says there's all these road races now that are going through the Back Bay, and at least with the Walk for Hunger or the marathon, you know it's coming, so you can plan ahead. You're in a neighborhood where you don't
even
know
so
it's
many,
coming.
There are all these kind of niche events that you have no idea about unless you're listening to the radio. Do you know about that run on
Santa Claus Run?
No, and that's that one. And then there's one in the middle of the summer, like July.
Cocktail Run?
They shut down Beacon Hill. It's the corporate challenge or
something
like that.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
There's a million of them. Have them in Hyde Park.
Exactly.
Mix it up.
Send them to Hyde Park.
Yeah.
Send them to Inman Street in Cambridge. That's where
they
should
go. Just to be clear, that people don't think that Zakim is with you on the Walk for Hunger, he says the Walk for Hunger is an exception because things like the Walk for Hunger, there's actually adequate notice to people who live
in these
communities.
It takes
way
too long.
You don't want the Walk for Hunger to happen either.
I know. It takes way too long.
I must say for the Walk for Hunger people, the marathon, as we all know, if you were on the wrong side of the marathon, the day of the marathon, you drive. We're in the Back Bay right now. How far do you have to drive to get around the marathon?
I had to drive to Newton.
I'm not Wendy Kamiker with this. I'd say I'll pay them not to walk.
Scott Lehigh wrote that walk in the idea section. But you need to drive from
here.
I think it might be almost to Framingham, frankly. You have to drive down the Mass Pike from here to Framingham to get on the other side of the marathon and come back down the other way.
Fair enough.
No, I've done
it. Okay, enough complaining, you two. Here it is. Here's why Emily Rooney joins us every Friday.
Incomprehensible.
It's out of control.
How about common sense?
Doesn't matter.
Why not? This is the kind of thing that drives people crazy. It's your right. Doesn't matter. I have absolutely no interest.
Well, we do. Is it thematic
and
participatory?
Do you all know what next week is?
No.
No.
It's the 100th anniversary of the big molasses flood.
Oh, I read that in the Globe. I did know that.
My
yeah.
God,
oh, then
the
you're going to know a lot.
Flood.
Okay.
Do you know why molasses was a big thing
back then?
No, I don't know. Do you know?
I have no idea.
I couldn't figure out why they've got this tank.
Containers?
So they were using it to turn it into industrial alcohol, and they could also manufacture munitions. They were also using it as a rush in advance of Prohibition, you know, assuming that was going to happen. All right.
Well, by the way, we preempted it. Take 30 seconds and explain to people who didn't read the Globe, don't know about it, what happened 100 years ago.
Well, it's coming.
Oh,
it's coming
okay,
in my
fine.
List.
This is awful.
So that was the first thing. Why were they building, and how big was that tank? How many gallons of molasses did it hold?
I would say thousands.
I'm not
2.3 million
gallons.
2.3 million gallons.
Write that down, Marjorie.
Was there any advance notice that there was something wrong with the tank?
Was there any advance notice, Marjorie?
I don't think so.
Oh, yes.
Oh, yes.
In fact, there was?
Oh, yes.
It was leaking. And kids were coming along making lollipops out of the molasses.
Ooh.
They were grabbing it and putting it on sticks. Do you know what the company did to fix that problem?
No.
They didn't read that part.
They painted it brown.
That's good.
They painted it
brown. They painted the tank brown.
I think that was smart.
So it was smart.
Good crisis intervention move.
All right. So I have that. In January, uh-huh. January 15th, 100 years ago, uh-huh. the tank explodes.
Yeah.
2.3 million gallons. How fast do you think that molasses was traveling? It was the dead of winter, 40 degrees.
No idea. What's the answer?
I don't know. 30 miles an hour?
Yeah, yeah.
Was it
that's pretty fast.
That's pretty fast. So, you could not run that fast.
Well, you could, but apparently what was happening was that the minute it came, it was hot in the tank. And when it came out, it was congealing really quickly. So it was just capturing people. It swept out a large, you know, section of the North End.
100th anniversary.
Yeah.
Next.
All right. How many people were killed?
How many people were killed?
I don't know. It was quite a few.
21.
Quite a few.
21.
How many horses?
Oh,
many
the poor horses.
How many?
25.
Oh, you're a big animal person. That's
what was the name of the company? Do you remember?
No idea.
Purity Distilling. And what did they have in common with the Titanic?
Leonardo DiCaprio was driving the truck? No,
I found this fascinating. It was the same kind of brittle steel that the Titanic was made out, that the tank was made out of. Yeah,
very good one.
Which was apparently not good. It was brittle, so it easily broke, which is why the iceberg broke. Didn't you always wonder why the iceberg broke? That? I mean, I know it was a big piece of ice and it hit it really hard, but apparently it was a very brittle steel.
Hmm.
Wow.
All right, how did they clean it up?
Go ahead, Marjorie.
I don't know. I didn't read the
story.
It was fascinating. They got horse-drawn fire hoses with salt water and washed down the streets and then turned the harbor brown.
What brown?
The Boston Harbor turned
brown.
This really isn't funny.
All the molasses going out into the harbor?
I have to say, I've read about this before. I find it one of the most fascinating.
It is pretty fascinating,
bizarre accident incidents ever in the history of the world, and it happened right in our backyard.
It is really weird. Yeah. Is there a new book about it?
I think there is a book about it.
Is there a book about it? I just saw something about molasses somewhere, and I must have been in a book advertisement. But it is, can you imagine?
So Mark Shanahan, you're right, wrote about this. I think it's going to appear in the Sunday magazine or something like that.
It was online the other day, yeah.
But, you know, people make fun of it because it was, you know, this bizarre accident with the goo and everything. And most people did get out of its way, but it was really. And then they said you could smell the molasses all the way through the next summer.
Until the MWRA came along. We only have a minute left. What are you doing tonight
doing? We're having, I don't know if you've discussed this at all, but Althea Garrison is a new Boston City Councilor.
There she is.
And about 20 years ago, 1991 I think it was, she was outed as transgender. But no one mentions it now because she doesn't talk about it.
By the Herald, by the way.
The Herald, yeah. I can't remember. Eric Fernstrom did it.
Yeah, it was. Went on to work for Mitt Romney.
So the issue now is she's the first transgender. Should the news media even mention that?
Which the Globe did in passing.
They
after
did
swearing
it
in.
After saying that she had been outed, but they didn't do it because she doesn't want to be referenced that way. Anyway,
got it. We'll be watching tonight, Emily Rooney. Thanks so much.
Okay, Emily joins us every Friday. Of course, you can watch her tonight, Beat the Press, Friday nights at 7 o'clock right here on WGBH Channel 2. Emily, thanks a lot. Coming up. The mayor of Boston, Marty Walsh, is going to take our questions and yours. The mayor is next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio, live from the Boston Public Library.
At noon on BPR, live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library, it's a pikelipse soon. The Mass Department of Transportation has announced its plan to build the biggest highway project in Boston in a generation. At noon, we'll ask Mayor Marty Walsh what this 10-year project will mean for our commute. They'll take your questions and calls on this month's edition of Ask the Mayor. Then a cat may have 9 lives, but a cat owner can't even get a second chance. The claws are coming out in a courtroom drama between a pet adoption agency and an owner who did the unthinkable, letting her cat outdoors. Boston Globe's consumer advocacy reporter Sean Murphy is here for that and more.
During his Oval Office address, Trump pitched his wall to communities of color. Did it backfire or not? Callie Crossey joins us for that. Then we wrap things up with our Friday news quiz. A vegan couple will do their best to turn us carnivores into herbivores. All that is next on Boston Public Radio. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. It's Friday, and we broadcast every Friday from the Boston Public Library, the WGBH studio here. Hello again, Jim.
Hello again, Margie. And joining us this for this month's edition of Ask the Mayor is, of course, the mayor, Marty Walsh. He is here to take our questions and yours till 1 o'clock. You can tweet him at BOS Public Radio. You can send an email to him at bprwgbh.org. You can call him at 877-301-8970. Mr. Mayor, do you know that the Newsfeed Cafe has the mayor's sandwich available at the Chicken Parm? Is it the Chicken Parm?
I think it's Chicken Parm. I've never had it, but I think it's good.
Bring it down, will you, please? You know? News, how are you? Happy
New Year. Yeah, there's about four of us, so four Chicken Parms. Things are good. You know, I was just thinking, I've been coming on your show now for 5 years.
Yeah, that's right.
And I need a little table.
Yeah, you should have
put
a table.
Put your stuff on?
Yeah,
you guys have the table. And the eyes are getting tougher, so
yeah,
it's harder to look.
Right.
I look down about another foot and a half. And so a little table.
Don't mayors have slush funds? You can just take the money out and bring a little table.
Yeah, we do have a slush fund. Maybe I'll use a slush fund here at the library too.
I think they'd like that. Yeah.
Or we'll raise taxes to buy the table.
Exactly.
Yeah,
it's good
I
to see you,
Jim's
Mr. Mayor.
A good carpenter in his spare time. Maybe you can make one of those little high.
I can make a doorstop unlike any other. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah, I'll have to talk to Tommy Flynn to see if you're if you're qualified.
So, Mr. Mayor, I'm wondering. We've seen stories in the Globe about people up there cleaning up the dog park in Charlestown and different things like that. How is this shutdown affecting the city?
Yeah. First of all, about the trash at in Charlestown and in Salty at Dorchester Heights, we have our crews out there now doing them every night. The impacts have been, outside of closing our tourist attractions in Boston, have been minimal to this point. I mean, when I say that, they're not minimal. They're very serious. Shutting down the government is terrible. 800,000 people, Americans, not having work and paid now for 3 weeks is horrible. The impacts of on our city, I'm talking about, you know, the tourist attractions are closed. The trash has not been emptied in those places. But the longer this goes, the more impacts it'll have. We're concerned about money that's in housing programs. We're concerned about money in public health programs. We're concerned about the unintended consequences of these different departments that can't get the recs paid in time, which is going to then affect a lot of other things in our city. So it will have a bigger, the longer it goes, the bigger impact it will have as far as programs and services that are indirectly given to the city. On a larger scale, certainly there's concerns around, in my opinion, on the FDA and not having our food inspected, on TSA, not having proper, I commend the workers at TSA who take this job seriously and say that it's their duty to still make sure that we're protected at our airports and our ports. But the problem is that these folks haven't been paid in 3 weeks, and they're not millionaires. We have civilians in the Coast Guard that work in our city that haven't been paid and aren't being paid. And the Coast Guard put out, everyone saw it, recommendations that you could do dog walking and you could do other things to make money, which is insane. So there are ramifications for folks that are listening in our city, that live in our city, that work for the federal government. So they're not having been paid in 3 weeks. So there are big, big concerns here. And I think that, you know, we've been asked a lot about what's going on. I mean, you know, the president refusing to fund the government and come up with a compromise deal on it because of a wall or a fence. And, you know, it's been said by Democrats and Republicans that it's not about a fence. It's about a proper border security. There's places on the border that the fence does work. I mean, it's protecting, keeping people separated or keeping parts of the country, I guess, locked down, if you will, what have you. There's ways of entry points into our country, and there should be. But there are parts that you're building a wall. I mean, you just climb over the wall, you go under the wall.
Yeah.
It really is about technology. But what it really is about, in my opinion, and I've said this before, it's about a comprehensive piece of legislation to deal with undocumented immigrants and immigration in our country. If you look at the periods in our history of our country in the last 100 years, it's generally a bipartisan group of legislators that get together. They come up with some legislation to deal with the fact that we have 13 million undocumented people in this country and to figure out how do we deal with immigration in this country. There's immigration that we need. Companies, hospitals, universities need immigration, and we don't really have a policy that works now. So I think it's unfortunate. The president, this is simply a political ploy. You know, in the very beginning, and these are for all the people listening on the radio and here, that, you know, the president's being held up by Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer. No, the president said very clearly in the Oval Office in his first meeting with them that if the government gets shut down, it's him shutting the government down. He said it. That's his words.
Yeah, but Mr. Mayor, in terms of the blame for this, or at least who should be compromising, what I still haven't heard a decent answer to is if exactly a year ago those same two Democrats were willing to give $25 billion for the wall, in return for which the almost a million Dreamers would be taken care of. Why don't the Democrats stand up and say, we'll sign the exact same deal, this time for only $5 billion, so it's a bargain. Yeah. So why was it okay then and it's not okay now?
And I think I agree with you in the sense of that's the compromise. And that has not been talked about. There's been two or three meetings with the president and legislative leaders, and they simply – and I am not in the room, so what you hear coming out of the room is that, you know – are we building a wall? No, we're not giving a wall. The conversation's over, and there's no conversation about what should be given in different areas.
But you'd endorse a $5 billion deal if the Dreamers were taken care of?
I think building a $5 billion wall and not bringing other reforms and other technology in place, I think it's a waste of money. But in saying that, if we could get the Dreamers resolved, if we could get a date certain to deal with immigration in this country,
the answer would be yes.
I'd say we should look at it and do it.
So, Mr. Mayor, I read a story, the lead story. Oh, there's your chicken parm.
I'm not going to be able to talk for the next half hour.
I think that's an escape for you. So the lead story in the Globe, Mass Pike and Alston, Soldiers Field Road are set for a major overhaul. Everybody seems to be happy. They talk about it starting in 2021, which means I won't be able to get to work, which may be a good thing as well. 8 years. Why should people who live through the Big Dig not worry that this is going to be Big Dig Redux once it starts?
This is a major change in transportation policy. This is more efficiency.
Can you describe it, by the way? Because I didn't.
So right now, if you look at the Mass Pike, when you're coming into the Brighton Toll, it loops around a big empty parcel of land to the right, or if you're going out, it loops around a big parcel of land to the left. It's up in the air. And every, say, 20, 25 years, you have to do construction work on that to reinforce the structure, to make sure the structure can support the traffic on there. What happens by bringing this roadway down to grade level, down to street level, what it allows is it opens up a parcel of land for development in the Alston area, in Brighton, Alston-Brighton area. It will cut down over years on the maintenance of an infrastructure that's going through the city of Boston that's up elevated infrastructure. It's basically what they're doing is straightening the road. There's also been some conversations, and I support this, of creating a commuter rail stop there, West Station, to have more access to the West and have more access from the people from the West to come into the city of Boston, the $1 billion, it's a $1 billion price tag. That number probably will go up because of cost of construction. But it's something that had been talked about under the last administration, and Governor Baker, his team, looked at the different options to see if there's a more efficient way of doing it. And ultimately, they came down on the side of this is efficient. It allows opportunity for open-up roads and better connections to Soldiers Field Road. It opens up better connections for pedestrians and bicyclists and green space. It opens up a lot more green space. It allows opportunities for better transportation connections. You know, when people talk about the Big Dig, it really is about connections. And, you know, I know some people think the Big Dig, I don't think anyone thinks the Big Dig necessarily was a waste of money. I think what they were concerned about was the inefficiencies of the management of it in some cases. I think people look at Boston now and say, wow, it was really a great thing to do because it's connected Boston by putting a park on top and making a lot of connections. But I think what we have to do is be very careful on the administrative side of it and making sure that the money goes into the construction and the building and the designing and the opportunities and not so much into the administration side of it. The Big Dig was criticized for all the administrative money that it went into.
We're talking to Marty Washington. By the way, the lines are full. But
Can I just go back to Trump for a minute?
Yeah, I just want to say, but our number is 877-301-8970, and they'll open up in a minute.
Real quick on Trump, and just to follow this along. So Trump and the Republicans and Democrats were coming up with a budget. And what happened was, and this is where you see how he gets his information, all of the press, both the liberal so-called media and the conservative so-called media and everyone in between, started criticizing or accusing Trump of giving in and not fighting for his wall and what's going to do. As soon as the press did that, I'm not blaming the press, but as soon as they did that, his information then, he flipped. So he literally sits home at night, I think, and watches these different stations and takes the criticism and gets angry at it and takes the praise on another station and takes the praise. So I think that, you know, when you think about your governing, you can't govern by what you're hearing about in the paper. Sometimes, I mean, editorial pages and editorials are editorials. They're exactly that. And what you should do with those is what I do with those is I take them, I read them. You know, initially, you might not disagree with it. You might say, okay, I can't believe they're writing that way. But then you have to really take a look at it again and say, wait a second, there might be some truth here. And there might be some, I might have to look at this issue a little differently and might have to not think I have all the answers. And I think that the president, he kind of follows that Twitter, and he follows that. That's where he gets his information, rather than listening to the people around him that he puts around him, because we've seen an exodus of some good people out of his administration the last 6 months who've given him advice, but he listens to, I don't know who he listens to, not to prolong it, but until that came out on TV in writing, then he switched his position hardline the other way.
It was Ann Coulter and Rush Limbaugh, too, on the radio saying he's going to fold. We're talking to Marty Walsh, the mayor. He's going to take your calls in just about a couple of minutes.
Yeah, one last thing before we get to the calls. These stories really upset me. I don't know if it's because it's the Me Too movement or because I'm a woman. I don't know. But for the third time in a row, this commission out of the city reported found pervasive unwelcome culture toward women in the Boston Fire Department. They talk about pervasive locker room talk, which is unfortunate because that's what the president called his talking about grabbing women by the you-know-what. Anyway, 16 women in the 1,500-member fire department. It goes on to explain, you got to have veterans preference, you got to have the civil service test, all this stuff. It seems to me, Mr. Mayor, when you've got a fire department 70% white in a city that's mostly not white, 60-some percent white cops, and in the fire department only 15 women, cadet program's not going to cut it anymore. I mean, you've got to do something dramatic, like get rid of civil service or get rid of veterans preference.
It's one tool to look at civil service, and I think it's very difficult to advocate and to really think about getting rid of veterans preference. You have people that put their life on the line for us in this country, that have fought in now for the last nearly 20 years, Afghanistan, Iraq, and other parts of the country, Syria and other parts of the world, to try and bring justice and try and bring stability to the region and to the world. So I'm not an advocate for getting rid of
the veterans.
You don't have
to get rid of it, but why does it go over people that live and brought up in the city of Boston who get preference over those people?
Well, that's one of the reasons why I am promoting the Firefighters Cadet Program. We have it. I reinstated it in the police department, and we've been able to get some women and people of color in through the ranks of the police department. It takes time to build up over time. But when you think about where we are today with 16 women on the fire department, having a cadet program over the next 10 years, we can make some significant improvements and gains in that area, as well as respecting our veterans and having the veterans' preference and having that. I also think we have to look at civil service and people signing up for the test. There are not as many numbers in civil service as there had been in the past. There's, the fee for civil service went up about 9 years ago or 8 years ago from, I think it was like $25 to take the civil service test to $200. So that's going to discourage people from taking that test because it's so much more money to take the test. There's a lot of other opportunities that we have to look at, and how do we create opportunity and promote diversity in the fire department. This is not a Boston issue. This is a national issue. Now, when you look at fire departments, and it's interesting, when you look at fire departments around the country, that most fire departments that have police and fire department separate, when you look at the other side, EMS, we have our numbers significantly go up when it comes to EMS, women on EMS. We have a system that's very separate. And when you think of firefighting, it's fire suppression, going into fire burning building, and it's EMT certified. A lot of what our fire department does today, I mean, they do fight fires, obviously, and we lost two firefighters a few years ago right here in the Back Bay. What they do is a lot of their calls are addiction. A lot of their calls are overdoses. A lot of their calls are car accidents. A lot of their cars are something that deems around having a lot more paramedics. And I'm not advocating for putting the two together, but we really have to think about, as we move forward here, thinking about, how do we increase the roles? Do we have to do a better job recruiting veterans, veterans of color and women to take the test? That's something that hasn't happened. We also have an issue that we have to work on internally. And, Joe Finn started several years ago training, and he increased training by 300%, by 30,000 hours of training of firefighters in diversity, in inclusion, in making sure that you change the culture of a fire department. We're now in this recommendation. One of them is that we're going to take this training and take it into the firehouses and talk to more. We've worked on creating separate sleeping quarters and separate bathrooms. Some of that started prior to both of our administrations, and we've taken it now, put locks on bathrooms and separate sleeping quarters. We're also dealing with firehouses that were built 50, 60, 70 years ago. So the new firehouses will be set up completely different. So there's a lot to unpack here. I was criticized the other day saying that this report happened in the past and nothing was done with it. Maybe, but that was a different administration with different fire commissioners, and we're taking this report very, very seriously, and we're going to look and see, you know, and I'm going to listen to ideas. If people have ideas, we want to know them, and we're working with the council, and Andrea Campbell came out the other day, and she put some report out on some recommendations. Some of her recommendations
wants to get rid of civil service.
They're already in place, but that's not something that we could do in the city. That's something you have to have that conversation at the State House.
So, Mr. Mayor, before we leave this, I think one of the people you may be talking about is the new Congresswoman, Ayanna Pressley, former city councilor. She's quoted in the Globe on this. It's distressing and infuriating, and it's not surprising. This report did not reveal anything we didn't know already. You commented on the missing table. You've been there 5 years. Did you need this report to know what needed to be done? Yeah, I mean, these people...
This report had to happen.
I'm not saying you didn't need it, but much of that's in there was publicly knowable. You knew there were 16 women. By the way, I looked up when you said it's a national problem. We have roughly 1% here, fewer than 1% women in New York City, but nationally it's 3 times as high, 3%. It's not enough, obviously.
No.
3% nationally. So didn't you know enough to have done more prior to this Hodge report?
No, some of doing more is we've done. We try to lay down on the culture of the fire department. Working on the bathrooms, working on the living quarters, working on the training, working at the academy with the new recruits coming in, all of that stuff we've been doing for the last 4 years, 4 or 5 years. As far as recruitment of fire departments, you know, we've worked with our Office of Veteran Services, Commissioner Giselle Sterling, to try and recruit, because this is an issue of recruiting and public safety, both police and fire, trying to create more opportunities for veterans of color and women to take these tests. So they have opportunities, because they'll have the same opportunity, same advantage as a white veteran by taking the test and getting more people to take the test. And those are things that we've been working on, trying to increase the numbers. And quite honestly, you know, we've been successful a little bit, but not enough. In this class that got sworn in on the 1st of January for the firefighters, we had 3 women in the class. One dropped out because of the physical.
Yeah.
One decided that she didn't want to be a firefighter, and we have one person in the class. This class that's made up of the 54 recruits that are sworn in on January 2nd, I should say, the demographics of this class are 98% male, 1%, almost 1.1% female, 63% white, 37% people of color, 7 Asian, 7 Hispanic, 6 black. The reason why we got those numbers in this class is that we went to the state and asked for a waiver. The last class, I don't have the exact number of the last class, but we went for the waiver in that one as well, and we got it. And then the previous class before that, we went for the waiver, didn't get it. We went for a waiver for women only, we didn't get it. So part of it is looking at possibly the waiver system to see, is there an opportunity for us to get some waivers here so that we can get some other different languages on the fire department, and also getting some... the woman that's going on the class, she's Asian. So, I mean, we need to get more demographics of different people on the fire department as well. So I think having that ability to be able to do that at a state level would be helpful. Again, I'm not criticizing anybody, but it's something that's serious. And because we're the capital city, we should be a beacon, and we should be that set the example for everyone else.
One very quick question before we get to the calls. You mentioned that Marjorie mentioned supported dumping civil service, you said.
Yes.
And you said, obviously, that you can't do that unilaterally here. Beyond the unilateral issue, do you support getting rid of civil service?
No, I don't support getting rid of civil service.
Okay. Let's go to the calls, Mr. Mayor.
All right, let's go to Connor in Brighton.
Connor, you're on Boston Public Radio with the mayor of the city of Boston. Hi.
Hey, Jim, Marjorie, Mayor Walsh. I actually had the pleasure of meeting you during your meetings in public parks this past summer that you do. You should definitely keep that up. It was a pleasure to meet you. I'm calling regarding an issue I'm having. It's a repeated issue now for 6 months with my landlord. I know that's quite common in the Alston-Brighton area. The building was bought, and they don't actually curb the trash in our building, which apparently, according to the Inspectional Services Office, is their responsibility since my building has three or more units in it. So the reason why I'm calling is that the Inspectional Services Department has been great, and they've come and they've written them up, but then the landlord actually has an opportunity to fix whatever issue is being called out. But the problem is that they know when the reinspection is going to occur. So the day of the reinspection, they come and they make it look amazing at my building. And then they come and they can't get reprimanded. So there's no recourse as far as I know. So I don't know if there's a better department I should call, if there's something that your office can do. But it's been 6 months now, and there's basically just a giant pile of trash sitting in the alley behind my building.
Yeah, there's a couple of things, Connor. Well, number one is stay on the line and we'll get your number. But I think that Inspectional Services is the right place to go. And this is for anybody listening. But we also have neighborhood liaisons for different neighborhoods. And we have one for Austin, Brighton as well. And what I'd suggest is you connect to the neighborhood liaison. And when something like that happens, you can call them directly and then let them call ISD to go out there, because we do keep a record of violations that people have. And we have inspectors in every neighborhood in the city of Boston every day, and we should be having them out there. And eventually, working through the neighborhood liaison, we can actually pull the owner in of the property and have a conversation with them. So I'd say anyone listening, that's the process. But for you, Connor, stay on the line and let me get some information, and I'll have somebody get back to you today.
Connor, don't hang up. One of our producers will talk to you. Mr. Mayor?
Ken in Medford.
Hi, Ken.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Hi.
Mr. Mayor, a brief background before my question for you, if I may. I have a 71-year-old friend of 36 years who had a mental breakdown over 10 months ago that is now stabilized and admitted himself to Mass General Hospital's Blake 11 psychiatric ward. While he was there, his Boston apartment building of 19 years evicted him because of his disability. And through a hospital social worker, we found temporary housing for him in Cambridge, where he is still living, while he is looking for affordable housing through various organizations like Elders Living at Home Project, HEART, Section 8 application, Office of Housing Stability, Housing Authority offices, Boston, Cambridge, Somerville, and Medford, and so on. We cannot continue to keep paying for this pricey temporary housing, but I am told I have to stop paying for him to stay there and kick him out onto the street to make him homeless now that in the dead of winter to be able to find permanent single-bedroom housing for him. My question is, where is the decency and compassion towards other human beings? I can't do this to a good 71-year-old friend of 36 years with his disability. Where can he go to find percentage of his income living space that will also allow him to buy food and clothing on his limited Social Security? What can he do?
Let me start by saying you're in some of the right areas in the city. And again, I'm going to ask you to stay on the line, Ken, so we can get your information and find out how we work with a lot of cases with people being evicted out of their homes on a case-by-case basis. Long-term, our housing plan is to create more affordable housing and housing for elderly folks and people with disabilities. That's in our housing plan spelled out. But we do have processes right now that are in place to try and help folks in the situation of your friend. And also in the legislative packets that we're putting up there, we have some bills, 14 bills on economic mobility around people. And one of them is eviction of people out of apartments that they would have right to counsel. Right now in Massachusetts, you don't have right to counsel. And also raising rents that we would cap the amount of rent that a landlord could raise on a senior in the city of Boston. Those are two bills that we're moving forward. It doesn't help your friend today. I get that. But these are the situations of your friend. Those stories are common. And you know, part of it is lack of housing, long-term housing for folks like that. I mean, the waiting lists are long. But I would suggest in your friend's case, stay on the line and let us try and jump into assistance. And anyone listening on the radio, if you have a situation where you're having a housing issue, call the City of Boston's Housing Stability Office. That's the role of our housing. If you're having problems with paying the mortgage and you're about to lose your house, call our office. If you're having problems with landlords and evicting you wrongly, call our office. We work on expiring use. That's what the office was set up for, and that's what the office intended to do, and they've had some good success.
Ken, we appreciate your calling for your friend, by the way. You're a good friend. Stay on the line.
And Tom, the last caller, I think it was Tom from Brighton, when you talked about Brighton, Austin Brighton, code enforcement just shot me a message that they'll be somebody I'll give a call to as well. So code enforcement are the folks that go out and write the tickets.
Mr. Mayor, before we take our bottom of the hour break, Margie and I on the air the other day were talking about your proposal reported in the Globe for higher fees on ride sharing because of congestion. By the way, I don't know if you listen every day. All we do is complain most of the time on the air. Margie and I, one of the things
I get a text or a call every now and then about you know they're on you again. Or
well, no,
about
we
you
were
again.
We are. Actually we were with you
it's
on
mostly
this
Jim,
one.
Of course.
I'm waiting for that text that you know Monty Walsh is the greatest ever. I'm waiting for that text, but I haven't got that.
Let
one
us
yet.
Know when you get it. All right? But in all seriousness, here the thing we love the idea because we're nuts about this congestion thing. A lot of people obviously care about it in the city. I didn't get a couple of things. Two clarifications. One, the increased fee would be for people who use rideshare but go solo rather than those who go. Okay. But secondly, the thing I didn't understand, if the goal is to raise the fee to discourage single-use rides, and the state law, which neither of us knew, neither Marjorie or I knew, said these companies can't pass along the fee, then how does raising the fee discourage the individual?
They'd have to pay the fee, so they'd have to come up with better ways of marketing their vehicles. And there's ways of changing the state law.
Wait, they the company,
but there's ways of changing the state law that can adapt to this. And again, the idea behind this is twofold. One is to try and encourage people, rather than having four people taking four separate Uber rides, four people taking one Uber ride. And that cuts down on cars on the street. And number two, those individual rides, those four people that are taking the four rides, doing a dollar or whatever the number will be at the end of the day, for each of those rides, we are able to take that money and put into an environmental fund to actually work on environmental issues in the city of Boston or wherever the rides are. A lot of the rides, I want to say, I don't have the exact number with me, somebody will text me, but I believe it's roughly 4 million trips a month. In Boston for Uber.
Four million?
Originate in the city of Boston.
Well, it's 100,000 a day, so that's 3 million. But whatever it is.
So, no, I think it's 4 million trips.
It is?
I'll get
whatever.
Somebody will send me the information.
It's a lot.
It's a lot of trips that originate in the city of Boston. So part of it is kind of thinking outside the box. This is a way to pay for some environmental programs that isn't assessing the taxpayer, if you will. But also, if you're an individual and you're riding an Uber, you don't want to pay the extra dollar. You will then take a car sharing service where there's two or three people in the car and the costs are down. And we see, the two biggest complaints, I get a lot of complaints, but the two of the biggest complaints are traffic. I mean, right now it looks great on Boylston.
Does.
But later on tonight, Boylston looks like Manhattan at night here. It's crazy. And there's half of them are Ubers, and they're pulling over and stopping in the middle of the lane, the left of the lane, the right of the lane, dropping people off, causing traffic. And then the other issue is the environmental aspect of what we're doing here in the city, making sure not just about resilient Boston Harbor and building a sea barrier, but also about what are we doing on reducing carbon emissions, what are we doing on green buildings, what are we doing on cleaning the environment, what are we doing on renewables, what are we doing on all the things that are important.
Where are you on congestion pricing before we break?
I don't really know enough about it. I probably should learn more. I know they have it in London. I don't have an opinion of it. I've been asked that question probably for the last 5 years, and I haven't honestly taken the opportunity to go back and learn it. And I probably should do
next
that
next month.
I'll know it by next month.
Yeah, we have a question just along these lines about timing lights. This person is talking about Mass Ave. I don't know if the lights are timed on Commonwealth Avenue or not. Is that something that anybody thinks about in terms of
a la
congestion?
New York City, which is elevated.
It goes back to technology, upgrading our technology, and I think that we have to do. We're working towards a system that we can actually move traffic around the city of Boston in a better way. Timing the lights is good during certain hours, but timing the lights also can slow down a parkway or a street. So, for example, if every light on Boylston's green at the same time, you're going to start down at Hereford and you're going to fly as fast as you can down to Arlington and try and hit the light cycle. So there's opportunities also to slow traffic down there. So we're working on that. Let me just to be 34.9 million trips originated in Boston per year. 96,000 per day. For context, that's 63,000 take the blue line per day. So when you think about that, we have 96,000 per day trips originated in Boston on Uber. In that same time frame per day, 63,000 take the blue line.
So obviously people are giving up on the T and going to Uber.
Yes. A lot. That's a lot of it, too.
Yeah. And the blue line's pretty good. You don't hear about driverless trains on the blue line, do you?
No. We got to take a break.
Tracks catching on fire. Okay. Mari Walsh is taking our questions and yours. You're going to keep taking them. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marge Regan. We're a little more than halfway through with the monthly Ask the Mayor. Marty Walsh is kind enough to join us almost always at our studio at the Boston Public Library and take your questions and ours. Before we go back to the calls, Mr. Mayor, after saying you were not interested in having the mayor sandwich from the Newsfeed Cafe, you've been shoving it
during
the break.
It's really good.
How would you rate it?
It's one of the best.
Okay. The food is very good.
And I'm tough on chicken palm, and that's a good chicken
one
palm
of the best.
Right there.
Okay, fair enough.
Let me just real quickly on the signalization. We retime our signals regularly, but we're working on adaptive signal technology. So we are working on that for the entire city so we can do a lot more. Some areas want to move traffic. Some areas want to slow traffic, particularly in our neighborhoods and our slow side streets want to slow traffic. And we also have a bill in the legislature that we're filing that's going to be a pilot that will put cameras in intersections on block the box. One
oh,
of the things
good.
We hear all the time. So
I love that.
We are not going for the full camera implementation program. Right now what we're looking at is cameras in certain pilot areas because block the box also causes an awful lot of traffic congestion when people cross into the intersection and cause gridlock.
So what do you do when that happens, Mr. Mayor? My strategy is to drive like about 6 inches from the car and just kind of toot the horn and stare at
them. And you hope that you move. But as more people block the box on your travel home, that means that there's less time to get through that light.
You know, before I go back to the calls, Mr. Mayor, at 877-301-8970, when you just mentioned the cameras in the intersections, what's the latest on the body cameras? Where are they?
They're working. I have to get an update. I know that I'm not sure. I think we ordered the technology. We're in the conversations now with the unions because we have to bargain on those because it's a change in
working conditions.
I guess a little bit in work conditions. So we're in the process of moving forward. We've identified the locations for them. I'm not sure if we have the technology yet. I'm not sure if the cameras are delivered yet, but I know that we're ordering them and moving them forward.
You know, this is not a huge company. It's not like getting Amazon here, although, frankly, I'm glad we didn't get Amazon here. But this is kind of a neat story about the wind turbine company picks Boston for its headquarters for all the United States. That's pretty cool.
I met with them yesterday.
You did?
Yeah, pretty interesting idea. Off of the coast of Martha's Vineyard, they have this wind turbine farm. They start talking about power, and they're just getting into this area and buying power in the region, being able to transport the power. Very interesting what they're doing there. I think there's about 80 turbines completely. The blades are 500 feet long each.
Wow.
It's pretty incredible what they're doing. And what they also told us is the environmentalists at first were opposed to them, but what's happened is that they've become coral reefs. So fishermen are going in fishing because they're finding great fish in there because they've become a natural coral reef for them. So it's just there's a lot of interesting stuff there. We met yesterday with the company, myself and our chief of the environment, to talk about some potential. They were just telling us about the product and about what they're doing. And then they were from Denmark, and they were talking about all of the incredible things they're doing in Denmark as far as renewable energy. And it's really incredible. It's coming. It's coming here maybe slower than people would like, but it's definitely coming.
You know, before we leave this, Marjorie mentioned the Amazon. I thought it was a great story in the Globe the other day about when they, I guess through Freedom of Information, they got a lot of the emails about the wooing of Amazon in part by John Barros, your economic guy, and Jay Ash, who was, I guess, the outgoing economics guy. One of the we're talking to Shirley Leung, the interim editorial page editor of the Globe, and she commented on the fact that the story mentioned that neither you nor the governor met with the team from Amazon when they're here for a day and a half. And she jokingly said, well, I wonder if that hurt us. Why did you make that decision?
No, that was one of the – I don't think they necessarily recommended it, but Amazon was coming here talking to our people.
Okay.
And it wasn't really a big sales pitch. I mean, GE was a similar conversation. They met with a bunch of people and myself and the governor and some other leaders in business.
But you were involved in that
we met with them.
North End thing.
The Amazon bid process – was different. I mean, something that I've never really experienced before. You know, I tried in my own way to get conversations with leadership at Amazon. I spoke to some people, but they were really concerned, more interested in meeting the people around around the administrations and around the city of Boston.
Were you at all aggravated? I thought so disrespectful when I read in that piece that when Amazon ultimately decided that they were going to split the headquarters too between Virginia and New York, the way the city and the state found out about it was when an email with a press release.
Yeah,
is that not disrespectful?
Again, I don't know who they had, who their so-called political people were around them, and I think that, you know, they're a different type of company. I mean, I you know.
Did that not aggravate you?
It didn't really aggravate me. I mean, I would have. I think I might have found out from seeing it on TV. I'm not sure.
Really?
But we have in Boston have a very good relationship with Amazon in the sense of right now that they're building a building down the South Boston waterfront. There's 2,000 jobs. They have 1,000 that came in. So they're very philanthropic. They've made some incredible donations to different organizations around the city. So that's a different wing. I mean, it's all different wings. It's such a big company.
Have you been reading Jeff Bezos' text to his girlfriend?
No, I haven't.
Okay, I just want
no.
Okay, let's go back.
I've been intrigued by watching. I watch my nightly CNN, MSNBC, and then I want to get a completely different vision of it, and I go to Fox once in a while for like 10 minutes.
That's good.
So I want that perspective.
It's a beautiful thing.
Can you imagine how much money Mrs. Bezos is
$70 billion.
Is that how much she's going to get?
He's worth $140 billion.
Right. So she's going
to
get
let's
half.
Go back
I'm
to
going
the
to Harry in Austin.
I
come
bet
on, Harry.
You are.
Save
go
me,
ahead.
Harry. Yeah.
Go ahead, Harry. You're on with the mayor. Harry.
Hi, Mayor Walsh. How are you today?
Good, Harry.
Great. So I was calling to thank you for your leadership on the Mass Pike Austin project that you were talking about earlier.
Thanks, Harry.
You did
some good work, too, there. Thank you.
Who is he?
Thank you very much.
Harry's a gentleman from Austin, Brighton. Does a lot of work around mobility in the community. We had a conversation probably about 6 months ago, more than one, but we had many conversations about the importance of this road and really this, the benefit of the design that was chosen or the option chosen really does more for mobility than the other one would have. It opens up, forget the fact that it opens up development opportunities, but it really does connect people better. And I think that that's something that a lot of people won yesterday when that announcement was made.
Harry, thanks for calling. I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Continue.
Sorry, I was just saying that's exactly right. And, you know, you mentioned your support for West Station earlier. I know you and your chief of streets are supporting dedicated bus lanes and footbridges that can connect Comm Ave to the Charles River parkland. And it's wonderful. Those are some of the real, you know, transformative benefits that this project can have for the, you know, $1 billion that we're all of our, you know, money is going to go into it. And, you know, we in the neighborhood really look forward to continuing to work with you on all of this in the, you know, months to come.
Harry, thank you for the call.
And I want to commend the governor, too, for listening. I mean, the governor heard loud and clear, and Stephanie Pollack heard loud and clear what the concerns were. There was many, 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 many meetings out there about this, and they listened to the community. And almost unanimously, the community wanted this option.
You know, in this Globe story, it talks about speaking about freeing up land, not just for the train station, but for dozens of acres of new development for Harvard University, which is loaded, as we know.
Yep.
Are they going to contribute anything to this? Or?
Yeah, but I think Harvard, Tom Glenn, who is at Massports now over at Harvard, it's not just about Harvard's university. It's about creation of an opportunity. It's about development over there. It's about whatever. There'll be a planning process, and we're going through a planning process, and we'll be having a more intensive planning process. Now we know what's going to happen. I envision shops and restaurants and retail and housing and businesses and all of that there. This isn't all about Harvard building a big mat. They're not going to build a university there.
Yeah.
There'll be probably some university presence there. But it's really about looking at that. It also opens up some opportunities for BU. And they've both been at the table with the past president of Harvard, who I had a great relationship with, President Faust,
yes.
and now the new president of Harvard, which we're building a relationship with. They're very concerned about making sure the community, there's a robust, strong community relationship. This is not of the old days when Harvard was going to do some development, and it seemed like there was a lot of animosity in the community.
Yes, I remember this.
People really change. They're trying to change that, and they're not trying to. They're working at changing that every single day.
But they don't pay property taxes.
No, it's not,
and
no.
So is there going to be a deal up front on this?
That land would have to pay. I mean, they'd
would have.
They'd
to
have
pay.
To pay. They'd have to pay taxes because it's a public use. It's not a university.
Are they pretty good? You were city council in Cambridge. I don't know how Harvard is. But we always have the stories every year about how much. What do they call the alternative?
Payments in lieu of taxes.
Some schools do really well. Some schools don't do
Harvard is one of those schools that does pretty
well.
Yeah.
Okay.
Let's go back to the calls.
We'll go to Sarah in Dorchester.
Hi, Sarah.
Thank you for taking my call. Real quick, Jim and Marjorie, I just wanted to mention that there's a public ceremony honoring the lives lost in the Great Molasses Flood. Tuesday, January 15th at 10:30 at Langone Park in the North End with the archaeology program, the city archaeology program, Boston Parks, and the landmarks. And I wanted to ask the mayor
a question
as well.
Sure.
Yeah, absolutely. Mr. Mayor, as you know, the city of Boston has an amazing archaeology program and has for the past 35 years. But one of the challenges recently, well, and the last several years, is that there's only one position and no budget, curating more than a million artifacts and conducting archaeological excavations, including, you know, as you know, the shipwreck that was found.
Down the waterfront.
Malcolm X's house, the Old North Church. Part of the way that the city archaeologist Paul Revere House, exactly, is by working with a whole cohort of volunteers. And for the last 5 years, he's had a lab manager that's been entirely grant-funded, and that grant ran out. And we're hoping, and we've been advocating the volunteers and myself for the past 3 years, for additional resources to fund that position permanently. And part of that position would help to coordinate all of these hundreds and thousands of volunteers who come out to help the city. And also, I just would want to mention that there's been increased demand placed on that department, and it just does an incredible service for the city, engaging the public, rapidly growing volunteer school visits, public programming.
So what's our question, if I may, Sarah? So, what's your question for the mayor?
So I'm wondering if this year might be the year that you fund the city archaeology lab manager position.
Sarah, what I'd like to do is I know you called before. Let me get your information here and hook you up with the right people so we could, because this is the time to talk about it now. This is the budget process has started. We'll be putting together a budget. We'll be unveiling a budget. We'll be moving forward. I just want to find out who you've talked to and find the right person inside my office to be advocating with you. And part of that, I'll hook somebody up with the Office of the Budget to talk to you about this as well, because we did talk about this before and other people have brought it to my attention. I went out to the dig at Paul Revere House. I saw what they were finding there. They found spoons. They found a toilet. They found a lot of things from back in the Paul Revere era time in 300, 400 years ago. So let me get your information. Don't hang up. Let them get in the back, and somebody will get back to you.
Sarah, stick around. Stay on hold. One of the our producers will take your number.
You know, Mr. Mayor, there was a story about Durkin Park closing down in Faneuil Hall the other day. It's been there for years, and I think 200 years or something
that. Yeah, it's a long time.
And in the context of that, it talked about how sort of the center of the city is now moving from Faneuil Hall down to the seaport. You think that's true?
I think maybe that's part of it. I also think Faneuil Hall probably needs some investment. It looks a little tired, and it needs to be brought up a little bit, and I think that we have to, you know, I'm going to have some conversations with the company that runs Faneuil Hall. They did have some proposals to bring more shops and more shopping opportunity experience to Faneuil Hall, and then there was a pushback from the people who own the shopping cart saying we like what we have, and I think there has to be a happy medium there. We have to look at both. I mean, we don't want to see the push carts be pushed out, but also we want to bring more people there, and if there's not a lot of reason for people to go there, to tour, that's going to be a problem. So we have to look at that. And that's something that we have had many conversations internally about. Faneuil Hall was leased out to a company. It's a different company that has it now for a very good deal for 99 years. They pay very little money to the city of Boston. We have very little ability to force things happen. So I think that Faneuil Hall needs a facelift.
How many more years on the 99 years?
65.
Oh, my goodness.
Mr. May, before we leave this, in the Globe story about the closing of Durkin Park, Marjorie and I discussed this on the air. One of the contentions, which I found to be not very credible, by the manager, one of the managers at Durkin Park, was one of the things that put him under was the increase in the minimum wage for tipped and non-tipped employees. What's your reaction to that?
I mean, I don't think that's the reason. I mean, I can't say. It probably did it add to it, maybe. But it does come down, and I don't know exactly what happened, but a lot of it comes down to location. A lot of it comes down to product. A lot of it comes down to marketing. A lot of it comes down to a whole bunch of different reasons. I mean, we have restaurants all day long. Some do really well, and some don't do as well, and you can't really figure out, you don't understand the difference between them. I guess you can, when you're going out of business, it's everything. I mean, it's the cost of supplies. It's the cost of employees. employees, it's the cost of overhead. And when you're doing really well, you know, those costs seem less important or not as big. So I don't think it's a minimum wage thing, because we're not seeing large closures of restaurants because of minimum wage increase. I mean, you're talking the lowest paid workers in the place who actually probably do most of the work.
Let's go back to the calls, Mr. Mayor.
Let's go to Annie in the car.
Hi, Annie in the car. How are you? You're on Boston Public
Hi,
Radio.
Hi, I'm good. Thank you. First-time caller.
Great.
Really appreciate it.
Great.
I wanted to ask you about the Lyft and Uber fee that you were talking about earlier. I'm currently a full-time Lyft driver. This is my primary source of income. And, I mean, we all feel the congestion of the Boston streets, but I think Uber and Lyft drivers are keenly attuned to it. And I'm wondering what we as drivers can do to help mitigate some of that congestion.
Great question.
And yeah. Make things better here.
I think it's going to be difficult for you, for any of you as drivers, to be able to go to Lyft and Uber and have a major policy change unless you can get a large amount of you drivers getting together to push up the company, because their business model is really top down, I think. And I think I appreciate that. I think that I think having dialogues, I don't know if you have a representative in the company you can talk to, but talking to them about being having creative ways so you can still earn a living, but also and not hurt your particular business and allow them to be successful. I think that in any suggestions you have, I mean, we'd love to hear them in our transportation department, something you might have, because you do it every day. We don't do it every day. So if you have a thought or a suggestion on something that we might be missing, please contact us. Call our transportation department. I know the commission is listening to the radio right now. Let them know that you're calling on anybody, Lyft or Uber driver. You're a Lyft or Uber driver. You'd like to ask for some. You'd like to throw some suggestions out there. We'd be more than happy to take them and think about how we can better push for some relief here.
Annie, thank you very much for calling.
Mr. Mayor, the Globe has reported on this Boston Public Schools policy kind of cracking down on kids that are close to their basically, they would accommodate children up to the age of 22, and some of those kids, I was surprised there were this many.
100.
Yeah, is it only 100?
I think it's 100 we have that are aged or aging out of the system.
Oh, okay. I thought it was more than that. Well, in any case, they're ejecting them on their 22nd birthday, even if they're close to graduating. So where have you come down on this?
I had a meeting yesterday with Laura Perel, the superintendent, to talk about this issue. There's some complexities here. It's not as simple as being reported. We have a system for kids with special ed that when they age out of 22, there's programs for them to go to. There's kids here at 22 that there's not programs to go to. So we're working to try and find out what's the right thing. I mean, the last thing we want to do is throw kids out that aren't prepared. But these are young people. Some of them, you know, either came into this country or they went back to school late in life, and now they're in public education. And the responsibility to the city is age 22 around education. But we're looking at different opportunities. Is there an opportunity for us to partner with an adult education program and turn a program into adult education? You know, 25 years ago, there was a big push in Boston. We had a lot of adult education programs in different neighborhoods coming up, and some of those are still there, some out there, and some are in different forms. So we have to think about how do we want, because my goal is to get people into college, into the workforce, and by not in having a person willing to take those steps, we have to figure out how do we keep them connected to school. And again, it's an issue that we have to deal with. It's one of those, you know, tricky policy issues, if you will. You know, at what point, you know, do we continue to educate in our public school system, which is a K-12 system? At what point do we continue to educate people?
So before you go, Mr. Mayor, could you give Marjorie an update on marijuana retail openings?
I read yesterday in the paper that we're going to have cafes,
I know,
delivery,
yoga studios,
and weddings, and all the other stuff.
And I read where your former police commissioner, continuing his anti-marijuana crusade, is cracking down.
He's listening right now. He said hello to you.
Commissioner Evans?
I meant to text him because Boston College was trying to, what do they call that bucket of blood?
Mary Ann's.
Well,
formerly known as Mary Ann's. I was never in there.
Yeah.
Actually, I never went in there. It's crazy.
It's out in Cleveland Circle.
I was in a lot of places, but not Mary Ann's.
Yeah.
What is the? By the way, that was the advisory committee that
they
recommended
to
the
a
full
pot store.
Commission. Where are we on retail openings in the city? What's the latest?
I'm not sure where we are. On the, we have one I think in the North Station area, that's moving. They're moving forward.
That's Ascend. That's Andrew Cabral.
That's one. We had a city council hearing that there was a lot of concern about having equity in the industry. Most of our applicants are white businesses, and there was some concern about not having enough businesses of color in this area. And, you know, we're trying to promote that as well. You know, there's some recommendations to go one for one. If we do that, we'll open literally right now. We'll probably open two marijuana shops in Boston if something like that were to happen, because there's not enough capacity on the business side for businesses of color.
But isn't that why the delivery services, which are much less capital intensive,
delivery is
so
an opportunity?
Yeah.
So, you know, it's another way of helping. But again, with the delivery services, just thinking of the economy, that's great. You have a car, you can deliver service, you can deliver marijuana, but that's not a business. I mean, it's a business, but it's not quite as lucrative as, say, opening a marijuana or a potential cafe. Anyway, we're heading down the road, and I'm thinking this space that we're in right now at GBH, if you guys aren't nice to me, we could turn this into a cafe, marijuana cafe.
I wouldn't upset
right
her, by the
We'd
way.
We'd probably make
me.
More money. I know, she'd be here calling in.
That's right.
All right. How you doing? What's going on?
That's right. Remember a million years ago, Johnny Carson, I'm dating myself, you're probably too young to remember this, but Johnny Carson was drinking on the air.
With a state trooper.
With a state trooper. And it was really incredible to watch him get drunker and drunker.
Show what the impact of drinking
was. Yes.
Yeah, you can't do that today.
No, you cannot.
And you shouldn't do that today.
Different world.
He Ubered home. I think.
Yeah, he might have back then.
So, okay. Mr. Mayor, thank you. And by the way, the chicken farm is on them.
Yeah.
Well, it's coming to heat it up.
Thank you very much.
Good to see you.
Thank you
very much,
Mayor Walsh. We very much appreciate it. Mayor Walsh James joins us every month. Tell Bill Evans. I'm going to text him myself, actually, so we miss him.
By the way, Commissioner Gross will be with us for his first regular appearance.
Yes, he will.
Next Friday, right here in the library. And on Thursday in Brighton, the governor will be joining us as well.
Mayor Marty Walsh joins us every month for Ask the Mayor, taking our questions and yours. Thank you again, Mr. Mayor, for coming in. Up next, the Boston Globe's Sean Murphy, part journalist, part corporate watchdog, joins us to talk about, speaking of Uber, an Uber driver with a short fuse, a courtroom showdown between a cat owner and the animal adoption agency, and other abuses at the hands of big business against our wonderful citizens here in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. He's next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio, live from the Boston Public Library.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. Even though the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau has been gutted, as Marjorie mentions every single day, we still have some protections thanks to Sean Murphy. He's a Boston Globe reporter and the man behind the fine print column, which takes on some of the toughest consumer predicaments and quite often solves them. Sean, it's great to see you. How are you?
Hi, Jim. Hey, Marjorie.
I love your stuff. I can't get enough these companies going after these people. And this one was really upsetting, because you always think about how people that, you know, rescue dog places or breeders or cat breeders are always like wonderful people that are out for the animal first. This situation does not seem to be a woman, an adoption agency that was out for the cat first. Tell us this terrible story about
this cat. There's an adoption agency in Salem, and a young woman decided she'd adopt Muse, a blue-eyed, gray-striped, half-Siamese cat. Abused, formerly abused with a former owner. Took Muse home, gave Muse a great home by all measures, only to have taken Muse out on a leash for less than 5 minutes, took a video, and as she said, stupidly posted it on Facebook. The owner of the adoption agency, it's actually a nonprofit, so the executive director and founder, saw the video and moved to take the cat back because of this one lapse in the contract for having taken Muse, the cat, outside on a leash for less than 5 minutes in her backyard. Pamela Howard, the owner, said, no, this is my cat. I feel like I'm its protector and guardian. I can't give it up.
And what did this cat adoption agency do?
You could say she did the American thing. She went into court and filed a lawsuit to take the cat back.
And the Pamela Howard, Margie and I are obsessed with this story, by the way.
She's up to
Pamela Howard spends
now.
$3,000 so to defend herself in a lawyer. And you make the point, by the way, when you contact either the lawyer or the woman who runs a nonprofit, they contend, well, this wasn't the only instance, but then you brilliantly go to the pleadings, I think.
Thank you.
And notice
say that again.
That nowhere in the court pleadings from the cat adoption agency do they allege that there was more than one
innocent.
No,
they only have evidence of once, and they're building the whole case on that. This seems to be overly litigious.
You think so?
It seems highly technical. If the point is to give these cats good homes... and it's in a good home. Would you do this?
And the cat gets attached to the person.
Cat seems lovely and very
content.
That's
the thing. It's like, can you imagine? Everybody thinks, you know, cats don't care that much. Well, sometimes cats do really care.
Yeah.
And they really get upset when their owner dies or their owner moves away or they have to be adopted or something. That's the thing I couldn't believe. Someone that would run a cat adoption agency wouldn't think about the emotional impact.
She is clearly passionate.
Yeah.
And maybe zealous.
Yeah.
And the protection of cats. Her lawyer said that he hopes that the litigation is over, that she's made her points, that contracts need to be honored, and he's convinced that Muse is in a good home now.
I love
stay.
This. He, who filed the lawsuit, hopes the litigation is over. But by the way, even though you're not giving yourself credit, I would argue that it's not just because they realize the error of their ways, and we don't know 100%. This
we don't
is
know.
Over.
We don't know
but the
outcome.
Way you read this, it seems to me the lawyer is now saying that the person he sued seems to be a good cat
that
owner.
That is correct.
Is because they were embarrassed in the Boston Globe, which probably should have been.
Well, yeah. I mean,
you didn't say
so
it.
So we
I did.
Hope, since Muse fate is hanging in the balance,
you really into this.
We hope that you're going to have a follow up on what happened.
Yes,
to Muse.
I must. Okay. I mean, it's still a live case.
She it's a live case.
She could file in Superior Court and press on.
She'd I think
have
she
to have a different lawyer.
To the Supreme Court of the United States. Now, Sean Murphy.
Another great story.
Our second favorite story. And the reason
by the way, the public really was captured by that cat story.
Of course they are.
It got the biggest response, I think, of, I don't know, some all the columns I've done.
And where were the people coming down?
Heavily on, in favor of the cat
the
owner.
Cat owner.
You
good.
Know,
oh,
keep
good.
Muse where, in a good home.
Yeah.
And it's a truism in journalism that pet stories really have
I know.
A lot of attention.
Okay, let's move
we
to humans
We used to have a motto
here.
At the Herald, but I don't think I can say it.
Oh, you can't. I know that. Don't say it. Now,
if it was at the Herald, it was something slightly vulgar.
Yeah, we've got animal stories, how well they do.
Yeah.
The second story, and I do a lot of auctions for nonprofit organizations, so I could relate to this one. Tell the story about these people that bid $7,000 for a trip to the Dominican Republic for 12, and what happened when they got there.
They bid. They go to this... Kentucky Derby themed party in Plymouth, and they put up this great vacation to the Dominican Republic at one of the resorts there, and they wind up bidding on it $7,000. They win. They're beside themselves with happiness. It's for 12 people, and they go about their business, planning to go, and in fact they do. They get all their bags packed and fly down there. And they arrive, and at the check-in desk, they say, well, you know, you're going to have to pay us another $10,000, you know, for food and drink. And
it's horrible.
And so the whole question is centered on what did they bid on? And the people, the Green family, they should have, and everybody should in these days, if you're bidding on something and you see a flyer or describing what it is, take a picture.
Absolutely.
You know, you have it forever. They didn't do that, and a dispute arose between what exactly. Now, the people who were running the auction,
by the way, they paid the 10 grand because they were there already and decided, we'll try, hopefully we'll get it back later.
Right, right. Yeah, they couldn't exactly turn around, you know, fly back 1,500 miles, et cetera. So the dispute is over what exactly was put up for bid, and the people that ran the auction really couldn't show me anything, couldn't document exactly what it was. And so I came down on the side of those who had bid in saying that, you know, of the two parties, the people who are running the auction have the greater obligation to document what it is that is going up for bid.
So do we have an outcome yet, or are they still out the 10 grand?
They're still out the 10 grand, and if they've, you know, they're going to have to file a claim if they want to pursue it any further.
Although one of the things I did think in this story, 12 people, 17 grand, that's about, what, 1,500 a person?
No, this is not fair. Wait a second. When you bid...
It doesn't cover the airfare, though.
When you bid at an auction,
no airfare.
You were there. You've done auctions with me, too, for nonprofits.
Yeah, Jim, by the way, is the auctioneer extraordinary. Okay, if you
don't
want to sell anything,
thank you.
Get
that
Jim
was
to come.
My
He's
point.
Really
no,
got it
no,
down.
Here's my
he
point.
Does that fast speak and everything.
Here's
yeah.
my
amazing.
Point. Here's my
and
point.
And sold.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Whatever it is you just bought. No, my point is this, Marjorie, is while... People who bid, particularly a lot of money like this, as opposed to like a small ticket item, they're doing it in part because they care about the goal of the organization.
That's right.
But they're also trying to get a deal.
Yeah.
And so occasionally, and you and I have done auctions together where there's an incredible deal because
a lot of people came
people
up to them and
bid.
Congratulated them. What a great deal
exactly.
you got.
And that happens sometimes.
A year ago, the same thing had been put up for bid and went for over $10,000.
Why was it 12 people?
There was two villas.
Oh, two villas,
yeah,
okay.
And they were supposed to be, you know, on a pool. There was a lot of discrepancies overall.
Yeah.
But if you're bidding for something, be business-minded about it. Make sure you've documented. And I say in the column, whether it's $7,000 or $70, I'm going to know what I'm bidding on.
So the next story, because it has a Cambridge base, and there's other connection I have I want to talk to you about, is about this 89-year-old woman who depends on Zipcar. I've told the story before. You've never heard it. The two women who founded Zipcar were in K-8 school. Their kids were with my kids.
Oh, yeah.
And not Robin Chase, who's the woman who's famous from this, but the other woman comes up to me one day before they founded it and said, Jim, you know...
Oh, you want to invest a little
money?
No,
she didn't. She says, but I really respect your opinion. We've got this idea of this car service where people
It'll never
rent,
work.
And what it, exactly, I said, listen,
no,
I love the idea.
It.
There is no chance. Yeah. And
no, I know you, Jim.
Now we know what the end of the story is. So tell the story of this. It seems to me this wonderful
89-year-old woman. She's lovely. A lot of the people I meet, and one of the pleasures of the job is meeting these people. She's 89. And by the way, she has a sister, I think, who's 188.
Yeah, that was great.
86.
Yeah.
And her mother
Good
lived
genes.
To 100 and, quote, has all her models. She's 89.
She looks terrific.
And she looks terrific and acts terrific and use Zipcar very regularly to run her errands, go to doctors, see friends. She's in a tight little parking garage in Cambridge, and she's a car comes... toward her, she moves a little bit to the right. She scrapes the parked vehicle. She goes through all the necessary steps to tell Zipcar about it and files a report. And they come back and they said, well, you're done. You're fired. You can't use our cars anymore. Your membership is terminated. And she said, why? This doesn't seem right. Well, they have this clause basically in their contract that says, you know, we retain total discretion as to who we're going to have as members. And they said that they have a practice. Anybody who's at fault in a car accident in the first year of membership automatically terminated and without any recourse or hearing or any sort. So, you know, I championed her, and I feel like she's a very good driver and capable, and service that she had come to depend on.
Can I add two facts to this,
Jim,
in your own
story?
What?
You got to tell Sean what you call people that are 89-year-old.
No, actually, you're the one who said that. Q-tips. She calls them Q-tips. It wasn't.
I don't call them Q-tips.
Because when they drive, because people get shorter,
yeah.
all you can see is a little tuft of hair above the dash. It's really horrible. Right. Marjorie's the one started that. Thank
too,
you.
Yeah.
Okay, let's get back to this.
Yeah.
Two other facts in your story, which you have left. This is your own story, Sean.
Yeah, sorry.
One, the woman sold her own car.
No, she didn't sell it. She donated it.
Oh, donate. Even better.
Yeah, maybe even to GBH.
Okay, so in any case, so that she's dependent upon, because she loves the Zipcar thing.
Yeah.
And two, I love the fact, didn't Zipcar allege that she was confused?
Oh,
and
yeah.
You, which is so disrespectful, particularly in light of the fact you said you spent time with her.
I spent
and she was totally together.
More so than present company, actually. Yeah. And she wrote this summary of the events, 5,000 words. It was beautiful. She teaches music at the Harvard Institute for retirees. She's just totally together. And it's, Zipcar seems to have misunderstood who they were dealing with, and they had some language about she didn't understand and she couldn't say what car she hit. She had photos of the car that she hit and furnished it and gave the license plate, et cetera.
So what's the outcome here?
Zipcar is not moving. They're, you know, she's still not driving.
Well, can I, let me
why don't
throw
you
in
say
two
what you think should happen to people that are over 70 years old and are trying to drive cars anyway?
Well, sadly, we don't have enough time. Now, let me just say this here. When you did your year-end review of yourself, and you looked at in the paper,
graded myself.
And you looked at you graded yourself,
it's
how
great.
Well you did, and talked about some of the great cases, I thought the most important point you made, while occasionally the column itself did the trick. It embarrassed the company, and the company did it.
Yeah.
But you made
not
the
occasionally,
point,
a third.
Well, I know that. But no, but
a
some
better
of those,
than occasionally,
no, but some of those times, I thought your point was it was the public reaction
to
your
absolutely.
Column. So if you care, in this case, if you care, whatever side you're on, comment on the story. That is what's going to move a Zipcar, or just like it moved
Norwegian
cruise line
cruise
for
line.
That great couple
yeah,
that you
Airbnb.
Wrote about. And so it's not just your story is my point.
No,
you made the point that when people get involved
power
and
of
care
the people.
About something,
power of people.
It's had an impact.
Absolutely.
On these.
Yeah, corporations, if they see some kind of a groundswell of criticism and it starts to seep into other news media, that's when they really get scared.
What would you say was your greatest triumph? I know you're very humble, but what? No, I'm serious. What
appearing
was
here with you, Jim.
What would you say of the cases you did? And by the way, we really do love this column, and I hope people
I
are
love
reading it.
It. I love
by
it.
By the way, somebody, if you do have want to get in touch with me, it's Sean, S-E-A-N dot Murphy, Sean Murphy at globe dot com.
I mean,
I
you
do
come
get a
to
lot
the rescue
of
the little old couple that got thrown out of the car.
No, but get to that in a second. So what was my point? What was the one, if you had to pick the one case from
it's
last
triumphs.
Year, what was the best outcome from last year? Was it the cruise thing? I
The cruise thing, again, here was a very, very lovely couple who had been terribly mistreated.
Didn't the husband go to Central High School? Well, I did.
In
Philadelphia.
Because
I met him here.
That's right,
afterwards.
He did. Yeah, he's a big fan of yours.
He's
too.
Fabulous. Yeah.
So
go ahead.
So they were treated very, very badly and brushed aside. Left on the dock as the cruise ship left, and
with all their stuff, right?
All their
luggage, their passports, everything.
You know, 3,000 miles away from home.
Terrible.
It was just cold. But after the column came out, Norwegian Cruise Line stepped forward and said, "We're going to give you a deluxe cruise to wherever you want to go, no cost whatsoever," and refunded their original cruise costs and paid for some of the necessities that they had to purchase.
Bernie Wax and his wife Dolly.
Bernie and Dolly.
He is fabulous. And but that's a huge deal, by the way. It's a very big deal.
Yeah.
So before you go, tell us quickly, Marjorie mentioned another
the Uber
octogenarian
case.
And this Uber thing. It's just unbelievable.
Gets picked up by a couple. They go to a dentist appointment. They're in their late 80s and feeling, having a lot of ailments to deal with. Both mentally and physically, and they get picked up, and they're going to go back to Needham, I think from Dedham. And the wife is sitting in the front seat with the Uber driver, and he starts along his course, and she says, you're going the wrong way. Now, she may have said it, you're going the wrong way, or you're going the wrong way. Well, in any event, the driver took great offense, pulled over and said, essentially, get out.
Yeah.
To this, you know, this couple.
It's cold out.
It was cold.
And he's got dementia.
The husband has dementia, right?
Yeah, it's dangerous.
They're both 87.
Yeah.
And their son then, you know, came to the rescue, or at least set out to rescue them. In the meantime, Needham police, is it Needham or Dedham? Needham police arrived on the scene. De-escalated the situation and drove the couple home.
Needham police
and the nice police sergeant.
Very nice.
Woman.
McCullough, is that her name?
Yes.
Yeah.
Kelly
she said,
McCullough.
Oh, yeah. She was a lovely woman.
Yeah, lovely woman.
She reminded you
Katie
of...
Katie McCullough.
Remind me of... she reminds you of your favorite aunt.
Yeah.
You know, and they, so it didn't seem like she was too much of a monster that she had to be let
out. She had two knee replacements and a hip replacement and macular degeneration. Yeah. She was not, you know, in great shape.
Didn't the cop, well, the cop also
some people
praised
argue,
the woman.
Some people do push back on my columns, and they say, well, geez, you're always taking the side of, you know, the older person.
Exactly.
Or you know, why? She could have been... combative, and I said, in the final analysis, no matter what she was, this couple, you take them home. You know, it's only another 5 minutes or so. It wasn't like they were going to be, abused. They weren't drunk. They didn't try to steal a car into traffic or anything. So
lovely picture of them.
We're
too.
With you. It is a lovely picture, actually.
Yeah,
you're doing God's work.
You are doing
Murphy.
God's work.
Let me just
well,
say
isn't
that.
Isn't it kind of nice, really? Because you know, as a reporter, lots of times you're doing stuff that.
And I did some of that.
Yeah, you know, people aren't exactly happy with you.
Yeah, right.
And this is like different. This is great.
Yeah, it is. But there is some pushback, as I say. People do disagree. There was somebody on the Cat case that said, the words in the contract are the words in the contract,
oh,
and they should have been honored, et cetera. But I do get to meet people who seem to be genuinely in need. A lot of the times, it's not the money, it's the principal involved.
That's right.
And they just want to be treated decently. And I get to get close to them for a couple of days, week, and sometimes a good... I think they all feel better for having done the experience.
Absolutely.
Know? And we feel better for having read
better
about
it. Okay.
Better
call Sean. That's absolutely the way
Sean.
It has to go.
Sean Murphy, great work. See you soon.
That's right.
Club.com.
Okay, we talk to Sean Murphy regularly. He is the man behind the consumer column, The Fine Print. And as you say, what's the email again?
Sean, S-E-A-N dot Murphy.
At globe.com?
Right.
Okay. If you got any problems,
thank you.
He's your man.
Roger.
Okay.
Jim.
Up
Jim
next,
right.
Did Trump's border wall pitched to communities of color backfire? WGBH Callie Crossley joins us for that. And more, you're listening to 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio, live from the WGBH studio at the Boston Public Library.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. Joining us as she does every Friday is the host of Under the Radar with Callie Crossley, who would be, by definition, Callie Crossley. Hello there, Callie.
Hi, Jim. Hi, Marjorie.
Hello, Callie Crossley.
I'm all fired up about that Uber.
Explain what happened with your thing.
Yeah, I'm driving to GBH and the guy tells me where the front door is. I said, I think I know where the front door is and you better turn this car around right now. So I'm sure my tone was not appropriate like the nice lady.
I don't think they're throwing Callie. Callie out of her Uber, yeah. Tell
Callie,
you the truth.
Were you combative?
I was very combative. I said, now. Turn it around now.
And I bet he did, or she did, or whatever it is.
Good for you. Okay, we want to play a little piece of sound. This is from the President's Oval Office address on Tuesday, talking about black and Hispanic Americans hurt by illegal immigration. Here it is.
All Americans are hurt by uncontrolled illegal migration. It strains public resources and drives down jobs and wages. Among those hardest hit are African Americans and Hispanic Americans.
Okay, his remarks have gotten a lot of pushback.
He says that line all the time, by the way.
Yes,
he says that all the time. Yeah, even though I think he's got the most horrible ratings among African Americans.
Yeah,
going.
He's saying it. It's not true.
Okay, so what is he says that's wrong?
So the issue, what are you saying? His assumption is that everybody is low-skilled, both in the group of immigrants coming in and African-Americans and Latinos already here, all right? So therefore, the low-skilled people are all fighting for the same low-skilled jobs. That's his thing. So that's not possible. But the issue is that there are a lot of low-wage workers, you know, struggle, everybody. And that's across the board. That's white, black, Latino, Asian. That's everybody in that group. So his making a distinction between Latinos and African Americans, of course, is to race bait. But that's actually not according to the statistics from the people who study this. These are, economists and sociologists. So I'm not just, making stuff up here. That's just not right.
So he obviously does this to make, as I think any politician would, even though hopefully most politicians will tell the truth more often than not, to make inroads into communities of color. Is there any evidence 4.5 two and a half years, 2 years and a month in, that he is making inroads with people of color in this country?
Yeah, it's happening so fast, Jim. You know, like every other day, he's saying something uplifting. Like, he's not a nationalist. Why don't people understand that? It's April Ryan who's the racist. Okay. I mean, I'm just...
No, I'm serious. Does polling data show any...
No.
Any, oh, so why? Please, so no. What is the point? What,
well, because I don't... You know, he's been using this line for forever and ever and ever, and I guess... As somebody smarter than me said, no one wants to be called a racist. They'll be one, but they don't want to be called one. So this allows him to say, that's not me. I'm out here in front saying that Latinos and African Americans are hurt most. I'm caring about them.
But right. By the way, well, one of the things he's not I'm sorry.
Well, I was just going to say, it's hard to say he's out for and concerned about minority rights, whether it's African Americans or Latinos or anybody else, when he's... The administration is considering a rollback of this anti-discrimination rules. And this is a little bit complicated, but it's basically saying, as I understand it, correct me if I'm wrong, that, say, for example, one of the reasons IDs, voter IDs, have a disparate injustice is because there are a lot of African-American, especially older people, who don't have them. So he's trying to he's trying to rejigger the law.
Right. So the law at this point takes into account that there can be good intentions in a law or good purpose, good policy made, and some of the side effects can be not good. I mean, we've all seen that in many instances that we can call up. So in the case of racial discrimination, it's not every day that I say to you or you say to me, I just hate you because you're black, and so therefore I can say, all right, I'm going to sue Marjorie because, you know, I know she just made it. It's never that way. It's a structural kind of racism that's built into systems. So maybe Marjorie's a banker. I go to try to get a mortgage, and you either do not approve it or you slow walk it. These are the kinds of structural racism pieces that are already there that people don't see and get very confused about. Well, what are people saying when they say racism still exists in a way that's quite significant? So what this law addresses in that would allow me, if I went to see you and you deliberately, because you've decided I'm not getting a mortgage because I'm an African-American, to say this is having a disparate impact on folks like me and others, and others in my group, okay?
Right.
Whatever my my protected class would be, that's the legal language. And so you would be able to sue and to get some kind of redress. Now what he's trying to do is undermine that law so that unless you stand on your desk with a sign saying, you will not get a mortgage, little Miss Black Girl.
Yes.
That's the only way that you can prove that there's discrimination.
So that's one of the many reasons that perhaps the African American community has not come around to. I think people are even aware that's going on.
Well, can I push back on that? Because I have to say, it is really hard to deny, even if you're not a Trump supporter, the wonderful work Ben Carson has done since he took over housing. I'm serious. Have you seen?
Oh my God,
Ben Carson. Once, except in the background of a photo opportunity?
Well, but what he's doing in the background, which is scarier because he's not been seen, he's cut, we have already talked about other departments in the government that have been cut to the point where they cannot function as any government department ought to be. It is especially bad in housing and urban development. He's cut through there like you can't imagine. And one of the huge issues that people are facing as they come to the end of the month who are not working, and all of these vouchers, Section 8 vouchers, are not renewed, is all the kinds of policies that he undermined or has undermined while he's been there.
Well, his contention, as I'm sure people listening know, is that if rents are higher, subsidies smaller, rents are higher for low-income people, it will create more of an incentive for them to go out and work harder, which, as if they are not desiring to have a decent job to begin with, but by him making it more expensive for them to afford shelter, he suggests that that will create an incentive that otherwise
does not
exist.
All I can say is that is one of the most nonsensical things I've ever heard, and from a man who is actually brilliant in his own arena.
Everybody says he was a great doctor.
It's just distressing.
I sat in my car. I'll give you the ultimate radio person's compliment Callie Crossley. I sat in my car for an extra 20 minutes after I got home last week to listen to the end of your discussion on your show about Michelle Obama's new book. You have a couple of great women on talking about this, and I didn't get their names, so you could tell us.
Janet Axelrod, who is on the Cambridge Board of Trustees and the Cambridge Library Foundation, and Betty Freeman, who's a former dean at the School of Law at Northeastern and a member of my personal book club.
Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm halfway through the book, and I know you've finished it already. But I wanted to ask you, because it was so clear to me, Jim talks a lot of time about Michelle Obama should, you know, be a perfect candidate for president because everybody likes her and stuff. But
no,
I thought,
not because everybody likes her, because she's unbelievably smart, unbelievably
tough, that's right.
unbelievably respected, and I think it'd be a real race.
But I wonder what you think. Now, I'm up to the point now where she's appalled at her husband's suggestion he's going to run for president, and she talks throughout this book how much she hates politics and never really wanted to go into it, and in a very frank way how ticked off she would get at him. She's home with these two little babies, and he's run around up there in the state capitol.
Making policy. And not at home.
So I wonder, do you think, having finished it, I don't see there's any, she just not.
Oh, no. But I didn't think it before I read the book. She said it many times, but I saw her at the Simmons Leadership Conference here last year, and she couldn't have been clearer in this way. And I really appreciate her answer. She said, you know, there are people who are good at this. Why do you continue, you voters, to look at people who are not good at this and who are not interested?
Well, I'll
and
tell you why. Both, I'll tell you why, because that's not true.
You know.
She is incredibly good at this.
Well,
she is strong. She's a fabulous communicator. She is, I think, a person who is really good on policy. And you know, I'm not taking sides in a presidential race. I'm just saying I think if you care about this country and you believe, as both of the Obamas seem to believe, that things that matter to them a lot are at great risk, that unless you find the perfect person or the close to perfect person to champion your cause, you almost feel an obligation yourself, despite all of the things, Marjorie, and you have just said, to do this. So I have no inside information, needless to say.
I would just take it one issue with you. It translates differently to the two of them. For Barack Obama, he sees, this is policy. I can go work with some people. I can change something. She is very unhappy that she's a great communicator. That's what everybody's responding to. Mm-hmm. She's a great empathizer and
it's
a storyteller.
It's a huge part of the job.
It is a huge part of the job, but she does not want to do the other part of that, which is walking through all the policy, because she says it's not in her. She gets too, she's angry, she's upset, she's frustrated. The incremental change is not, she can't deal with it. She's amazed that Barack can continue to go forward when there's like the tiniest little, you know, thing that works. I mean, she couldn't be clearer, and I admire her for knowing who she is and where her lane is and where she wants to stay.
You know what I also loved about it, where she talks about how a lot of it, this is, he was from Hawaii, you know, the way he walked around, the flip-flops, and very laid back. I used to have this boyfriend from Hawaii in college, and it drove me crazy because he talked so slowly. And he says, hey, you know, how's it? Can't you? And I saw that.
By the way, her roommate in college wrote about Marjorie and her boyfriend from Hawaii naked on the beach in California.
That was not true.
Oh, wow.
But there is that different slower tempo. I mean, it's really good. And I'm listening to the Audible.
Yes.
Where she narrates it, and it's really good. Okay, we wanted to just
by the way, speaking of Obama, I almost never listen to the show after we've done it, ever. It's not because I'm not interested in it, just it gives me hives. I mean, we did what we did, move on. I pulled a little piece of Jay Farrow yesterday.
Oh, doing the Obama. Oh,
doing Obama and him doing Obama.
Right, that
when
was
he
funny.
Encountered Barack Obama at Harvey Weinstein's house before Harvey Weinstein, that was the monster that he was. If you haven't heard that
was
by
funny.
The way, it was one of the funniest. And by the way, there are a few tickets left.
He's
I heard
Wilbur.
The Wilbur Saturday night. I'm going to be there.
That was funny.
Don't miss it.
So, Callie Crossley, this is one of my favorite stories of the week. Tell about this dad with the app that locks the kid's phone until the kid replies.
Well, I should do the preamble and say I have no children. My sister did that in our family, and I told her all the time when these
kind of apps came out to track kids, I would track them within an inch of their lives. And she was horrified by that. So anyway, this dad creates an app that you put on the kid's phone. And if the kid does not respond to your text, which they are wont to do, you get to lock it down. They can't do anything else. There's no surfing the web. There's no texting their other friends. There's no checking their, you know, Facebook or, you know, Snapchat or whatever they're doing. You can't do anything. The phone becomes a, you know, object that you could put on top of a stack of papers.
That's it.
I love it, love it, love it.
Well, wait a second.
And if they continue not to respond, there is an alarm which bypasses the signal that you put on your phone that says, you know, do not disturb or make no noise or whatever. It still bypasses all that. I think this is fabulous. This is right up there. This is better than the one that I heard about a couple of weeks ago. This is the mom that told the daughter, the only way that you can get to use the Wi-Fi or get the Wi-Fi code is after you finished your chores.
Oh, that's pretty good
luck.
Too.
She said you can figure it out after you finished your chores. But good chores.
But think
good luck
about this,
you.
Especially when your kids are younger and they're out somewhere, and you expect them home at 10 o'clock, and where are they?
And they're not answering.
Marjorie,
they're not
excuse answering. Me. I told you a story.
Yeah, you did.
I told you a story. This is 2 days ago. My older daughter is 27.
Yeah.
I'm driving home. And I drive by the iPlace called Customize in Central Square. Right. Great people. And I look, I'm at the red light, and I look, and who's the only customer in the store but my older daughter?
Right.
So I feel, oh, how sweet is that? She's talking to the owner, who's this wonderful guy, Kev Ork. So I, at the stoplight, I shouldn't say this because you're not supposed to use your phone. I was at a stoplight. I called my daughter on the phone, and I'm looking at her as the phone rings. She picks up the phone, looks at it, hits the cancel button, and puts it down because she has no idea that I'm watching her. It was unbelievable.
Yeah, what did she say when you talked to her?
She laughed, and then she said, well, I was in the middle of a conversation with Kevork, and I didn't. It was pretty great.
Yeah,
so
well,
I'm getting this app right now.
Yeah, apparently. Let me see. How many people have gotten it since it went out last year? I want to get the number. It's a lot.
By the way, Tori, or one of our coworkers, said to ask you if you've ever seen the episode of Black Mirror called Archangel about the technology that allows parents to see what their kids are seeing.
Wow.
Through a chip in their brains.
Wow.
Sign you up,
Callie. Sign me up. I want to know. This app has been downloaded 75,000 times. So just
great.
Want to say, I love it.
Callie, what are you doing Sunday night?
Sunday night we're doing a Latinx roundtable. We're talking about how Hawaii's population has increased, its Latino population since 2000 by 80%. People don't think of Hawaii as being a place that there would be a number of Latinos there. We're also talking about the piece that Marcella wrote in the Boston Globe about this informal helper chain of people not being going beyond sanctuaries, how she's titled her piece, and realizing that people who need help need somebody to go to court with them, somebody to help them. They often land in a town like Boston. They don't know anybody, and they're just at risk of being preyed upon by so many different people. So that's a very interesting piece. And that Latin albums are through the roof in terms of what everybody is listening to in some of the most popular songs. So we got a whole range of both cultural and other stuff. And the second part is about a Springfield girl, a Muslim girl who should have gone pro as a basketball player, but because she wore a hijab, they told her no. So she took her case, you know, all the way to FIBA, and they overturned the rule. But it's perfect timing in terms of telling the story through this documentary. It's called Life Without Basketball, because as you know, the Democrats, the first thing they did when they got in, because they have two Muslim hijab-wearing congresspersons, they changed that rule.
Changed the rules, yeah.
Yeah. So,
great.
Yeah.
We'll be listening. Callie Crossley, thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Callie Crossley. Callie Crossley, the host of Under the Radar with Callie Crossley, which you can catch Sunday nights right here on 89.7 at 6 o'clock. You can subscribe to her Under the Radar podcast on iTunes. Follow her on Twitter at Callie Crossley. Up next, a formerly carnivore couple are here to sing the praises of going vegan. Can they convert the rest of us? They are next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio, live from the WGBH studio at the Boston Public Library.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. The last time we discussed going vegan on the show, or at least discussed veganism and how Marjorie and I are too wedded to our milk, butter, and in my case, liverwurst, to fully embrace a vegan diet, the challenge of a vegan taste came up, which inspired this from one of our listeners. Actually, would be great to have, this is a quote, to have former meat eater turned vegan present to offer fun advice and perspective during this taste test. I'm a local and would love to do it on behalf of Boston area vegan publishers. For male perspective, my vegan scientist hubby can join too. Well, with a new year underway and in the spirit of turning over a new leaf, we have taken this vegan couple, who are former meat eaters, by the way, up on their challenge, and I'm going to introduce them as sitting in front of me is half of Marty Walsh's chicken parm sandwich that he left for me, and beef barley soup from the Newsfeed Cafe, which is terrific. We're joined by Lorelei Plotzik and Craig Tambell. They're the vegan duo behind the Eat Plants / Drink Beer vegan blog. Lorelei is also active on the Truth or Drought blog, a vegan environmental campaign, and she's media director for Boston-based vegan publishers. She'll have a book coming out later this year. Lorelei and Craig, it is great to have you. Thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Okay, so how did this happen? You wound up getting married and both embracing the vegan lifestyle. There was a story before this.
Yeah, so I was vegan when we met, and Craig was not. And
California, yes?
Yes, we were living in San Diego at the time.
Aren't you glad you're not in San Diego today? I tell you, it's 20 degrees.
Oh, my gosh.
It would be nice.
San Diego. I am from here, though, and I went to Emerson College, I should add.
Oh, yes, down the street, yeah.
So on our first date, or maybe you want to tell the story about the Bloody Mary.
Oh, that was our second date.
Our second date.
What happened?
So we went to a brunch at a local bar, had a Bloody Mary. The Bloody Mary came with a slice of bacon, some shrimp, a bag of pork rinds.
Sounds good to me.
Yeah, I'm just popping them back, and she's like, you know, kind of casually mentions the vegan thing. I'm like, oh, yeah, that's great. You know, just kept on eating, and then, you know, over time with the self-reflection and just kind of realizing that how I was behaving wasn't in line with my values and how I thought animals should be treated and things like that, I just kind of slowly made the transition.
Well, wait a second. Is that really true, or you just wanted her? I mean, was that the is that the price of admission, or what? Is the moral vegans, or are you health vegans, or both? Which are you?
Well, I should say veganism is an ethical stance against animal exploitation.
Okay.
Eating a plant-based diet or a vegan diet is part of that ethical stance. So we're definitely, you know, actually I started for health and environmental reasons. I became interested in plant-based eating for those reasons. And I think once you kind of start eating that way, you're able to see that it's just really not that hard. It's actually enjoyable and versatile way to eat. And so then you can kind of open your heart more to the animals and the ethical.
You know, the thing that I think provoked your, did you text us or tweet us, whatever you did that started this relationship, you tweeted us, was I think the contention that I was made, there are a lot of good vegan restaurants. My younger daughter, who's not a vegan but occasionally eats vegan stuff, would take me, and the food was great in a vegan restaurant. But my contention at the time was that every time in my house we try to make something that's vegan, it tastes like cardboard. And your contention, I think, was it's not so hard. And so as we're doing the quiz, you actually brought some things for us to taste and be honest. You're going to be okay if we're not crazy about this, correct?
Oh, of course.
I was going to say there's definitely vegan things that I don't enjoy eating, companies that make things that I prefer from other companies. It's just the same thing with grades of meat. Like, some people don't like certain cuts, other people do.
Different kinds of cheeses. And also, your palate really changes over time. I grew up in New England eating, you know, corned beef and cabbage and all that stuff that we eat. Like, this was foreign to me at one point, too. But your palate really changes. I was addicted to cheese. Last time I had cheese deliberately, it tasted, I can't even explain, it just kind of, like, gamey. And it just grossed me out, actually. And I didn't eat a meal without cheese.
Okay, so
that.
Before we start the quiz, give us something to taste, and we'll give you feedback on it. What's the
so
first
we start
thing we're
with
getting
the,
here?
The walnut milk.
Oh, walnut
Have
milk.
Have you tried that yet?
No.
I've tried oat milk.
Okay. So
and what do you think of that?
Oat milk was pretty good, actually.
It was okay, yeah.
So this is from Elmhurst, which actually is a historical dairy, and they converted to nut milks because the times are a-changing.
So did you put nut milk in your coffee?
Yep. Yeah, we brought you coffee creamer, too, because I've heard you talk about that's a challenge for you.
Yeah, because I like a lot of milk in my coffee. I like a lot. I could give up meat in a second. The hard part for me is that milk and the eggs and the yogurt.
So just drink this. I want to drink this walnut stuff straight, correct?
Yeah. Yes.
Okay, here it is.
Shoot it.
Okay.
Well, first of all, it smells like walnuts, which I love. I love walnuts. And Well, Marjorie hates it. I can tell. I know her for 20 years.
You have to like walnuts to like
I actually,
this.
I like this. I, you know what I'm going to do as we're sitting here? I'm going to pour it in my coffee.
Yeah. And, oh, we brought coffee creamer, too.
Oh, fine. Well, let me pour my coffee.
Creamer. If you want more, we've got plenty.
Okay, fine. I like it. So Marjorie hates it. I like it. That's a good No, it's a 50-50
story. It.
Yes, you do.
It's
you hate
thin.
It.
Have
it's
you
thin.
Tried the other, like, soy milk and you said oat milk?
Oat milk. Well, you know why I like oat milk? Oat milk is a mild taste, and it's also very creamy. I like whole milk. I don't like skim milk. Mm-hmm. So I like whole, thick
Okay, let's
milk.
Start the quiz, and then we'll try the next thing. Okay. We'll sample the next thing. Who do you want to ask?
Okay, we'll start girl, girl, boy, boy.
So you're going to ask Lorelai. Good.
Ready, Lorelai? This week, a prominent British art expert. And by the way, everybody gets all the quiz questions wrong.
No,
so don't
they
worry
don't.
About
Actually, they don't.
A it's prominent okay. British art expert, Dr. Brendor Grosvenor,
exactly.
revealed what shocking truth to the Sunday Telegraph in Great Britain. A, that he was harboring the stolen paintings from the Isabella Gardner Museum heist. B, that he was in possession of a rare nude photograph of Prince Charles. Or C, that his cat, Padme, had clawed a hole in and destroyed a rare portrait worth thousands of dollars.
Great question. What is it?
I'm going to guess B.
Good guess.
Craig, you can steal this
Incorrect.
Baby. Do you know what the answer is?
50-50 chance. I'm going to go with A.
No. Well, it is the cat that ruined this rare portrait. Claudette.
Do you think the vegan diet is affecting your intellect in any way?
You know, or
do you
know?
I was going to say, I think it's our newborn child.
Okay. Oh, you have a newborn
child? Oh, I saw
child?
A picture of that.
Month old. She's over there.
No, she is not. Where is she?
Yeah. Oh, she's the
Hi,
blonde
is the baby
right
with
there.
You?
That's my friend Amy.
Hi, Amy.
How old
Hello,
is the baby?
Baby. What's
Two
the baby?
Months.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank
so you're up
Hi,
all night.
Okay, so...
Yeah, that's been, too bad. Yeah.
Craig, if you get this right, I'm going to offer you Marty Walsh's chicken parm sandwich
and
to
I
take home with you.
And I will politely decline.
I know you will. Because of the government shutdown, the panda cam at the Smithsonian Zoo has gone dark. But another cam in London, Craig, offers some counter-programming. What is it? A... The Museum of London has installed a live fat cam, which is trained on their Fatberg specimen. B, the cat fight cam, which tracks the ongoing feud between Larry, the chief cat at 10 Downing, and Palmerston, that's the chief cat at the Foreign Office. Or C, the baby blimp cam, which tracks the slowly deflating Trump baby blimp, which is tethered, Marjorie, please, which is tethered to Nelson's column at Trafalgar Square. Is it A, the fat cam, B, the cat fight cam, or C, the baby blimp cam there. Take it away.
I'm going to go with the fat cam.
You are
that
correct.
Is exactly... Do you know what a fatberg is, you guys?
Yeah,
I do.
Okay.
Yeah, they keep on dumping fat and bacon grease
into
and
the sewers.
Yeah,
and then
down the drains, it just coagulates and sits there and it doesn't go away.
Oh, another problem caused by meat eating.
Exactly.
That is exactly right,
by the
way. If
people weren't vegans, they wouldn't have that problem.
Probably not.
They wouldn't have that problem.
So we discussed...
Vegan diet is also good for losing weight, I've heard, too, that if you go on a vegan diet...
Well, they both look really fit.
Yeah, you're both really thin, that you can lose a lot of weight in a vegan diet. Is that true?
You can. I mean, we don't really like to promote it from that standpoint.
Okay.
I've met people that have, for sure.
Yeah.
So we talked a couple of days ago, because we are relatively humane people, relatively, Marjorie and I. We talked about a law that was passed in Oregon that made Oregon the 26th or 27th state to allow for eating roadkill. Massachusetts already allows it. Would that be a suit? You know, we're not killing an animal for whatever. We're not going hunting.
Somebody
but
ran
it's
it over.
Dead, waste not, want not. Can you live with that or no, Craig? Don't look at her. Look at me. Go
All
ahead.
Right, I'll look
What's
at
the
you
answer?
Then.
We talked about
it. Yes.
Okay. And?
Well, it's one of those things where just because an animal dies and you think that, you know, it's okay to eat, you know, from a roadkill standpoint, it kind of still creates a way to look at the animal still as a thing than that its purpose is to serve us. And it's not necessarily needed to be eaten. It can create other problems where people are driving around just trying to...
Okay, how about
things.
Invasive species? Are you willing to eat that or
wait,
not?
But can we go back to the roadkill? It's
sure.
also like, well, would you... All the dogs that are euthanized, that's perfectly
no.
good meat. So
yeah.
all what we're up doing is upholding a cultural norm that we've been conditioned to believe that dogs are not edible and, you know, a deer is. But in other countries... They eat dogs.
You two are good advocates for your cause, I should say. Next question is
okay,
1-0, Craig, at the end of one round,
here
I should
say. Here
you
go, Lorelai. If you subscribe to this Fringe Theory, then this vacation might be perfect for you. Tickets are now on sale for a trip in 2020 that offers what? A, a 3-day all-expenses trip, including camping, to Catalina Island for people like Stanley Kubrick, who thinks human beings have never landed on the moon.
B, a retreat to the Amazon rainforest for those like Elon Musk who think that we are all just living in an artificial reality controlled by an artificial intelligence, or C, a cruise to the edge of the earth for people like Celtics player Kyrie Irving who think that the earth is flat.
I don't know if I totally got this, but
it's close enough.
It's a fringe theory, and this vacation might be
guess
perfect
again,
for you
because you're really doing a good
theory.
Job with the vegan thing here. Guess again.
C
is correct.
Okay.
Excellent job.
That's correct. Most now, before, of us do not think the earth is flat.
Well, speak for yourself. Now, Craig, before we get to your question, what else you got in that bag there?
Oh, we got some yogurt because I know that
yogurt
is a huge thing.
Marjorie's I eat yogurt. Marjorie's a huge yogurt.
I'm big on yogurt.
Kinds. Have you tried a vegan yogurt?
No, I never tried a vegan yogurt. Okay. So I'm going
to
try the vegan yogurt.
By the way, I love the walnut milk. I have to say I've been drinking it.
Okay, soybeans. Okay.
Soy-based.
Soy-based.
Soy-based, okay.
Wait,
right.
Let's pause and let's hear what Marjorie's
stirring
it up.
A
it's
bit.
A strawberry flavor, ooh. Silk soy-based
okay,
yogurt.
Here it is. Let's see.
Actually, that's not bad.
You like
that's
it?
Pretty good. I
really?
Like it. Yeah,
okay.
It's not bad.
Does it taste different to you? Or?
Yes, it does taste different. It's got a little bit of an aftertaste.
A good aftertaste or a bad aftertaste, Marjorie? Okay, thank you.
It's
let's
not
move
bad.
On.
It's not bad.
By the way,
it's much better than the walnut milk.
Is it possible, this aftertaste thing, I've had some of that issue with like vegan pastries when I buy them at Whole Foods or something. When that's all that's there and I buy them again against my better judgment, the second or third time, I've often find the aftertaste tends to disappear, meaning you get used. Has that been your experience or you're just so all in that you...
I never noticed an aftertaste, but your palate definitely changes.
Because
those are acquired tastes for dairy. I mean, some people would have never had dairy, and they would have it. And you know.
So this is the thing. You have to give it a little time. I mean, when you first decided to go vegan, it wasn't like the first day you were thrilled.
Yeah, weren't you roasting a pig we read when you met Lorelei?
Well, not when I met her.
What? I didn't mean
that. Not that exact moment.
No, about 4 or 5 months before I met her, I had a pig roast.
You don't
in my
miss
backyard.
Pig roasting?
No. Oh, I'm still a foodie. I still eat amazing cuisines from
you
around
do?
The world. I make, dinners every night using a bunch of different spices.
All right.
Here's
your question. It's one-to-one, by the way, in case you were curious. Craig, you ready for this question or not?
Yeah, as long as I get two chances.
Okay, that was her, not you. Police in Alabama issued a warning to motorists this week who were picking up dinner on the way home. Which one really happened? A, an 18-wheeler truck crashed, spilling boxes of chicken tenders all over the highway. Police told motorists to stop pulling over and eating them. B, police warned Alabama drivers to stop scooping their roadkill off the highway, warning that skunk stew was a health hazard. Or C, Alabama officers are warning drivers not to do the viral internet sensation, the Bambi's Mom Challenge, where you hit and kill a deer with your car and eat it on the way home. This is Alabama, so, I mean, is it A, B, or C?
Well, this question isn't very vegan-friendly,
no,
is
no, it is not, but it's the real world we live
in
here.
I know. The chicken tenders.
That is right. Oh, you said that with great confidence. You apparently knew that. Is that correct?
I did see that.
Okay, so it's 2-1 before we go into the bonus round.
So you guys have
forget question. You have more food or you don't?
Oh, yeah, we do.
You guys have a new baby. Probably not doing a lot of, dinner parties. But I do. So what do you do before you had babies? If you were going over having friends over for dinner, would you
great
do the vegan thing and try to ease them in with some sort of super delicious vegan thing? Just say, this is our meal, get used to it?
A little bit of both.
I'm trying to think. I mean, we've had like vegan dinner parties where the guests were already like either vegan or plant, like interested in plant-based eating.
Okay.
We've had your friends that like
cookies. Are those
have
cookies?
A farm. With
no, it's a tofurkey slice.
Oh, a tofurkey slice.
Love that.
We've had your friends over that are not vegan at all, and they were really impressed. I mean, he's a really good cook. So.
You are?
Yeah.
Okay, what am I eating again
here?
He's a
really good cook.
Well, the spices must be key,
what is this before I pop it in?
This is a tofurkey deli slice.
Oh.
We just grabbed the stuff at Star Market. I wish I could have got you some other stuff, but...
Pass that down.
Okay. I just washed my hands, so...
We have a baby,
It's fine.
I literally just washed my hands.
Well, I have to say, even though I'm eating into the microphone, which is probably not great... No, I know you don't want to do this, but trust me on this. Your concern is the consistency. It actually almost tastes like meat kind of. That's the smallest bite I've ever seen. What do you think?
Like, if you ate this in a sandwich, you wouldn't...
I didn't eat it in a sandwich. I think it's great. And it's got a little spice thing in there.
I can't do it.
You can't do it.
So is this like a mental thing?
It is a mental thing.
I don't know.
Thing.
You know,
because,
I
mean, think about if it's a dead animal.
You're right. I mean, the intellectually, you're absolutely right. I just can't get around.
I think we need to just... maybe give it to you and you not know that that's what it is.
By the way, I agree.
But I like the yogurt. I like the yogurt. I like the oat milk.
Okay.
So that's, I'm part of the way
we
there.
We have some creamer
and the creamer.
You.
Okay, we have better half creamer.
Actually, you know, forget the bonus round. This is much more interesting, and we're learning. So what else? Do you have anything else in there, Craig, or what's the deal?
Oh, yeah, we do.
What do you have? Let's eat vegan.
Well, just
let's
another.
How about chocolate cake?
No, I was actually going to make some, but...
Well, actually,
when
it's
I came,
not,
I know. When I came home last night... I had
well, wait a second.
Is that liverwurst?
What is that thing?
Well, this we
you'll
can't,
have to
we
cook
can't
at
eat
home.
Right now, but you can, it's a breakfast sausage that you can make into
oh,
patties.
How does that fry
up. It's actually really good.
Really
I use
good.
It all the time to make like biscuits and gravy.
So if I put on a blindfold,
yeah,
and on one in one plate was Jimmy Dean sausage, which there are rumors I might eat from time to time, and another plate was what's that called? Gimme Shelter. What's that called?
Gimme Lean.
Gimme Lean. Yes. Gimme Lean. Would I know the difference if I was blindfolded in your estimation or not?
I would say you would know the difference, but
it'd be fine.
Yeah, I would say you'd like them both. Like with most sausages, with a lot of things, it's really the spices and the flavors.
Can I tell you the other thing is I think the psychological thing. You asked a minute ago, Lorelei, about Marjorie. It is a psychological thing. So how do you overcome that to at least give it a try? I mean, that seems to be a problem, does it not?
Yeah,
for
I mean,
one of us.
I think the more you learn about the environmental and ethical ramifications of animal consumption farming. The more you just stop looking at animal products as food and you just, I don't know, I mean, you just make a transition. And the first couple of months are when it feels challenging, but at this point, for us, it's kind of just second nature. Like, we don't live our lives feeling like we're, like, restricted.
Deprived.
We really
so
don't.
Do you have a favorite vegan cookbook or a couple of them you think are really good?
I love Chloe's Italian Kitchen. She's okay. The woman who won the vegan or the Cupcake Wars show, and she happened to be vegan.
Ooh.
Can you have pasta? Can you have pasta?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Can you have pasta? Of course you
I wasn't
have.
Sure.
Oh, yeah.
Check
well, out our...
Well,
our,
I was going to say a lot of fresh
Wait,
pasta.
Wait, check out what?
Our Instagram. Oh, yeah. It's called Eat Plants, Drink Beer. And because he does homebrew beer. And we
I thought
post
pasta had eggs in it.
Not
fresh pasta
usually.
Does.
Some, okay. Yeah. But we post pictures of our dinners and our
So
meals.
Why don't you go the whole nine yards and invite us over for dinner? How about that? I'm not saying we'd come, but why don't you invite us and then we'd consider coming? You're looking at me dubiously.
No, I will. You can,
where do you live? Because we don't travel well.
We live in Uxbridge.
We could consider that. Is this a formal invitation?
Yeah,
or
it'll
not?
Be a formal invitation.
Okay, we'll consider it. We will seriously. I want to give this a shot, Marjorie, even though you're reluctant, apparently.
I'm not. I did try the oat milk. That wasn't what
you
we
did.
Had today,
and you
but
like
I did try
the yogurt.
Milk.
There's
I like
another
the yogurt,
yogurt
too.
I have
good.
A forager
okay,
on cashew and
okay,
it's cherry flavored.
I'll try
flavored.
The cashew
On that
cherry
note, we got to go, Marjorie.
Oh, we do. Okay.
We do. Hey,
right,
you too.
Okay.
Lorelei and Craig, we really appreciate this. This is a great effort, and I am moving in your direction, and I'll work on her, and we can't wait for dinner.
Oh,
just
my
keep
God.
Walking in the right direction.
Why don't you
exactly.
We'd love to have you.
What did you have for breakfast, Jim?
A pound of bacon. No, I didn't. I did not. I had a turkey sausage.
Turkey sausage, that's right.
But that's
right.
At least moving in the right direction.
It is, okay.
No,
next
not.
Time
it's
you moving. Can have the sauce.
I will. I'm going to try that.
Lorelei Plastic and Craig Tambell are the vegan
Good
duo behind
too.
The Eat Plants, Drink Beer vegan blog. Lorelei is also active on the Truth or Drought blog, a vegan environmental campaign, and she's media director for Boston-based Vegan Publishers. She's going to have a book coming out later this year. Let us know when you do, please. Lorelei and Craig, thank you very much for coming in, and thank you all for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tune in Monday for our politics roundup. Charlie sent the latest global headlines, and we're going to have a live performance by the group Guster, performing from 1:30 to 2. I'm going to play you their song.
It's right now. This is called Hard
oh,
Times.
Are.
Their brand new album comes out Friday. Guster, they started at Tufts, then they became internationally huge. The album's called Look Alive, and they're playing live over at GBH Monday, 1:30 to 2.
It's
we are
exciting.
Psyched on our show.
I want to thank our crew, Chelsea Murrs, Amanda McGowan, Tori Bedford, Jason Teresky, Arjun Singh, our engineer, John the Claw Parker, our on-site engineers, Dave Goldstein and David Cleckley. Special thanks to the folks at the News Feed Cafe. I am Marjorie Egan.
I am Jim Browdy.
Thank you so much
have
for tuning in.
Have a wonderful weekend.
Please tune again on Monday. Yes, as Jim said, have a great weekend. Go vegan.